Test, test.
Good, thank you.
Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Health and Human Services. And I would like to start by introducing the Sergeant of Arms from the House. We have Reggie Seal and Martha Parrish. And from the Senate, we have Steve Wilson and Anderson Meadows as our Sergeant of Arms. Before we begin, we do have one of our new representative elects in the room today, and I'd like, if Representative Murray, Representative elect Fulcham is in the room, and just like to recognize him. Congratulations, and we look forward to working with you in the coming weeks. Thank you for being here, Representative elect Fulcham.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Before we start, may I ask a question?
Go for it.
Does the leadership of this committee have any plans to discuss and make recommendations regarding the health exchange, which is an extremely important issue facing all states right now, especially in North Carolina when we have 1.5 million people with no health insurance? Health exchange will provide a way for them to help them in purchasing insurance, also to find out if they have any, will get any assistance in their purchase of insurance. But if we don't have plans to discuss that, tell me why not.
Chairman Dollar?
I guess my response would be, as you know, the House passed House Bill 115, did a lot of work on that. It went over to the Senate. I think there was a general view that folks wanted to see what the outcome of the Supreme Court case was going to be, as well, frankly, as the outcome of the elections. At this stage in time, General Assembly is not in session, so therefore the General Assembly cannot act on, and it's we're adjourned sine die at the moment. So past legislation would have to be some new bill that would be a part of that. And I would imagine that new legislation would be potentially contemplated in the next session of the General Assembly. It's my understanding that the more immediate deadline is for an indication from the state would be this Friday, November 16th, and I think I heard somewhere where there may be an extension of that into December. But that will be up to the administration and Governor Perdue to make an indication to the federal government as to North Carolina's intention.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, sir.
Representative Dollar, do you agree that this is an important health issue that, and why would it not be under the level of what this committee does to have a discussion about this and make some recommendations before the General Assembly meets?
Well, I can, just speaking for myself personally, and I can only speak for myself personally, I would hope that the governor would make the indication to the federal government of the state's intent to pursue a state health benefits exchange and keep that option open for whatever action the new General Assembly may wish to take early in the session. But I think right now it's in the hands of the governor as to whether or not the governor is going to give an indication one way or another to the federal government. As I see it, it's in the governor's hands at this point.
just follows. I appreciate your comments, but you really didn't answer my question about this committee's responsibility related to that issue.
Well, we will, chairs will take it under advisement, the request under advisement.
Before we move to our first item on the agenda, we do have the minutes, and if you've had those on your desk, and if we could approve those minutes at this time, if there's a motion to do so from Representative Hollow to approve the minutes without objection, the minutes are approved. So moved. First item on our agenda is the NC Pre-K overview from Donnie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee and members of the audience. Today's presentation will be an overview of the NC Pre-K program, formerly known as MORT 4. My presentation will be a prelude to the DHHS presentation on the implementation of Executive Order 128, whereby the governor has increased funding for the NC Pre-K program. NC Pre-K is a pre-kindergarten community-based voluntary program designed to prepare four-year-olds for kindergarten. The program is based in child care centers across the state and funded through general fund dollars. This slide shows eligibility requirements for the NC Pre-K program. There are three basic requirements to be eligible. The individual child must be an NC resident, must be 4 years old prior to August 31st, and be eligible for kindergarten the following year, and the family must meet income guidelines as set by the state of North Carolina. A family's income must be at or below 75% of the state median income for that family to be eligible, and that determination is made by the local DSS offices in each county. We'll look at the history of the NC Pre-K program. NC Pre-K began as the MORT 4 program. It was a pilot program established in Session Law 2001-424 with an initial appropriation of $6 million. That legislation also established a task force and provided some program guidelines regarding its design and operation. In 2011-2012, the MORT 4 program became NC Pre-K. The program was transferred from DPI to the Department of Health and Human Services, Division of Child Development and Early Education. That transfer accompanied an appropriation of $128 million, split between $65 million in state funds and $63 million in lottery funds. Historically, the MORT 4 was also funded with a split of lottery and state funds as well, general fund dollars, that is. In 2011-2012, also, the MORT 4 program previously had been funded, was allowed to be funded with some child care subsidy funds. That was disallowed with the 2011-12 budget. We'll look at the funding history of the MORT 4, now known as NC Pre-K. You see that its initial appropriation of $6 million in 2001, funding increased all the way through 2008-2009, remained relatively stable through 2010, and the 2011-2012 session, the program saw a 20% reduction from $160 million, which was the 10-11 amount, to approximately $130 million in 11-12. Similarly, you look at the number of children served by the program. The program numbers reduced by approximately 25,000, just under 25,000, in 2011-2012. We look at the last 2 years of funding for NC Pre-K. You see that in 2011-2012, general fund appropriation was $130 million, and 12-13, $128 million. So the program remained relatively stable for those 2 years. 2012-2013 budget action, the most significant budget action was the creation of a pilot program that provides funding for NC Pre-K classrooms on a per-classroom basis. The logic for that change was, well, not necessarily a change, it's a pilot program, was to look at the feasibility of funding classrooms as opposed to slots to address the provider issue of needing a base number of slots to make the program adoption feasible for those centers. And the Division of Child Development is slated to provide a report to the General Assembly on January 31st to look at the number of children served in that pilot program, the amount per classroom, and the amount per student to do a comparison of the two types of funding. This brings us to Executive Order 128. Several weeks ago, on October 18th, the governor issued Executive Order 128, which directed DHHS to utilize funds from across several divisions to fund additional pre-K slots. According to the order, it was issued in response to the August decision of the North Carolina Court of Appeals in the Hope County Board of Education versus State of North Carolina court case. The department is here to discuss the implementation of the order and to provide details related to the source of those funds. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I'm open to any questions. We also have individuals here from legal research to answer any questions about the legal issues related to Executive Order 128.
There, Representative Brisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the 2012-2013 budget, I know that we did, of course, everybody had to deal with some cuts, but what impact did it have? I know that the 2013 budget is supposed to be, we had more dollars to activate in January. What impact of enrollment did that have by us not letting it start off in July 1? Do you know?
I'm not really understanding your question. Could you please?
Well, the money, actually, the money that in the budget, we had two or three programs that would be activated January 1. And, of course, I felt like that at the time that would have an impact on enrollment. Do you know?
Well, that determination has not been made yet. That January 1 determination is based on the adequacy of Medicaid funding and whether or not the Medicaid funding will be sufficient enough to fund those programs in the HHS budget. That determination has not as yet been made.
And Representative Brisson, the $20 million you're referring to that's got that piece in it that would trigger the funding in on January 1st doesn't affect MORT 4. That affects part of the Smart Start, the Partnership for Children funding, but not the MORT 4 section of the budget at this time.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm.
There are no other questions. At this time, we'll hear from Senator Blake.
Here over here, the chairman.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And the committee chair, on eligibility, the term that you use, be a North Carolina resident, does that suggest that you just have to be living in North Carolina? You could be not a citizen of the U.S., but still be part of this eligibility. That's a question.
I'm not exactly sure exactly how that specific determination is made, but we do have Deb Cassidy from the Division of Child Development. She can probably provide specifics regarding that eligibility determination.
We do ask for a question about citizenship when parents are enrolling in the program. So we do require that information be gathered upon enrollment.
Just to follow up.
Follow up?
My real question is, if you are not a citizen of the U.S., are you entitled to this program?
Ms. Cassidy.
We operate pretty much along the lines of what the North Carolina public schools do, and so that if the children are residents of the state of North Carolina, then yes, they could be served by pre-K.
Just to follow up.
Go ahead.
If you're living in North Carolina, you're a resident of the state. My question is, why would this be a question? The point is, we're talking about who gets to participate in the program. Question is, be a North Carolina resident allows you to do that. And my question, if you're not a U.S. citizen, are you still eligible for that class, if that work?
Yes, that's correct.
Chairman Dollar?
Thank you, and
Chairman Burr, you may want to weigh in on this if I state it incorrectly, but what I'm trying to get at is, and you may have this number, I'd be interested if you have the number, when the programs merged, the MORT-4 and the pre-K were merged together, there was an element of that that included co-pays for certain individuals, and that created a number of additional slots because of the additional money coming in from the co-pays. When Judge Manning initially ruled and took out those co-pays, that cut funding to the program. And I know that it was a number of slots that were essentially reduced. And I guess my question is, how many slots were reduced, or how much money was cut from the 2011-2012 year based on Judge Manning's actions?
We do have that number. I'm not sure I have it right here in front of me, but if I don't have it here, I have it back at my – hold on just a second. I'll see if I have it located here. But I can't get the number for you here shortly. I don't have it here running.
Okay, but you think it's close by? But
yes, it is.
At any rate, but you confirm the fact that we lost several million dollars and some number of slots based on Judge Manning's decision to not allow copays to be charged.
That's correct. Once the copay was disallowed by Judge Manning, that dropped down a significant number of slots that could be allocated across the state of North Carolina. That's correct.
Thank you.
It was a significant amount, Chairman Dollar, and I'd also to that point point out that last year when the governor did a similar action as to what she just recently did with the Executive Order 128 and took money out of child care subsidy out of another part of early childhood education, by doing that she took away additional copay dollars that could have gone to fund additional kids to be in these programs. So, I mean, we've seen in several cases where the numbers that would be able to be served through pre-K or through the subsidy program have been cut because of those actions of Judge Manning and of Governor Perdue. Any other questions at this time for Donnie? If not, we will hear at this time from Secretary D'Elia. Do you have another?
Yeah, I just found the Sherman Dollar. I'm sorry. It's about 3,000, a difference of 3,000 slots between with the copay versus without the copay.
Thank you. Secretary D'Elia?
Donnie? I was told you were going to hand me the clickers. Stay on one slide the whole time. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. It's my role to talk about the pre-K program and the expansion required by Executive Order 128. And I have with me Deb Cassidy, Director of the Division, who may be able to answer questions that the committee may ask. I wanted to go through very quickly this slide presentation. We, in response to Executive Order 128, we took a look at the state, polled each of the 100 counties with regard to the capacity and their ability to serve children beyond those that were being served at the start of the school year. We were told by the counties that they could serve an additional almost 8,000 children, 7,978 to be exact. We have allocated funding to be able to support just shy of 5,000 kids beginning in October all the way through the end of the year. Of the 100 counties, 94 of those counties will be participating in the expansion of the pre-K program. All the counties that requested expansion funding, were granted a prorated allocation equal to about 62% of their requested number of children. The average cost per child of expanding the program is about $542 a month, and that does include startup costs as well as the administration costs for serving those children. The breakdown of the expansion, because as you know, children are served in a variety of ways in a variety of institutions, including public schools and private child care centers. You'll see that breakdown of how that service will be provided. 2,200 or so will be provided in child care centers, just shy of 1,200 in public school settings, about 744 in Head Start and other settings that are yet to be determined, about 822 kids. The expansion timeline, the governor's executive order asked us to serve up to 6,300 kids beginning immediately. That beginning immediately, we looked at existing capacity in classrooms across the state. In other words, classes where fewer than 18 kids were being served. That's really kind of the benchmark measure for the size of the classrooms. And so immediate capacity was surveyed across the state. And we were able to find that about 1,184 children were projected to begin in a pre-K program across the state starting in October. In this month, we expect another 2,000 or so children to be added to the pre-K rolls, with just shy of 700 more being added in December. Beginning in January, we project an additional 1,070 children to be served. And what that will mean is, as I've stated before, this, in my view, is a win-win-win. We help the children and really change the lives and the trajectory of their lives for four-year-old kids for the rest of their life. We are helping to employ additional people. As you see on the final bullet, we expect up to 550 additional teachers to be employed in this way. And certainly for those small businesses, many of which are those child care centers, we are able to provide additional revenues to bolster those small businesses across the state. Where are we now? As of the end of a week before the end of October, we were serving 25,100 children across the state. As of last week, we were serving just over 26,000 kids, and that number will increase between now and the end of the calendar year. As I mentioned earlier, we expect just shy of 8,000 children to be served for a total additional cost of $29,200,000. We are projecting a prorated amount to be made available of about 62% of that request, with a total cost of just under $19 million. That will serve an additional 4,965 children. We are going to be monitoring the actual enrollment across the state. Our numbers are based on the responses that we received from all 100 counties, and we're monitoring to make sure that the responses are actually followed through on and are able to be delivered on by each of the counties, and we will make adjustments as necessary as counties are able to accept more children or fewer children based on the local conditions. A local contribution is anticipated from the counties. That is part of the history of the pre-K program. Those local contributions come from those sources listed there: Smart Start, Head Start, and public schools, exceptional children, and Title I dollars. A question has been raised as to how the number of 6,300 was arrived at in the governor's executive order, and I will refer you back to a plan that was developed after Judge Manning's original order. The Division of Child Development was asked to take a very close look at our capacity and our ability to expand the program in North Carolina, and at that time, a five-year plan was developed for expansion of the program to meet the requirements of Judge Manning's orders, which was to serve all at-risk children in North Carolina. That plan called for 6,300 kids able to be served as we expanded that capacity, and that's the number that was used in the executive order. This number, again, was based on the capacity in the system and our ability to expand the program both administratively and in terms of delivery of services over that five-year period of time. To the extent that we can accelerate that, we will certainly look at that opportunity. And certainly it's something that it's still in the court system to be determined ultimately, but we are following the law of the land as it is currently and has been upheld by the appellate court. Child placement in each classroom is determined at the local level. That continues as it has been. Children may be served either in new or existing classrooms. Because of the cutbacks that occurred 2 years ago in funding, we had some latent capacity that counties across the state have been able to call on quickly to bring teachers back that had been employed, to put classrooms back online, put classrooms back online that had been housing children. So we are able to cause that to occur pretty quickly. I've mentioned already other funding sources that constitute the local contribution to the pre-K program. Many questions, of course, have been asked about the funding that the department is using to expand this program, and I have listed here the sources that we have identified and are using to date. I won't go through all of them in detail, but I'll highlight them each. You'll see that we expect about $1 million in LAP salaries to be used from a variety of divisions in HHS, $5 million in projected unexpended funds for the ADAP program, the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. One word on the ADAP program, because a number of questions have been raised across the state about the use of that money. This is a program where the administration has been able to eliminate the wait list. We have no wait list. It has been closed. We've been able to expand the program back to the levels it was before, where we are providing service to all eligible residents of the state at 300% of federal poverty. So we do not expect that the reduction of this $5 million will impact services for any of the people in the state who are eligible for those services. Similarly, in LAP salaries from the early intervention division, section rather, of the Division of Public Health, we expect about $6 million to be able to be used to that. $2.5 million in unexpended funding from the foster care services. Similarly, we don't expect that those services will be affected. Children will not be affected. We have made tremendous strides in the last couple of years in how we provide services to foster children, being able to provide those services and being able to keep more children with their families. So we expect that it will not impact services for foster care services. And then we also expect another $5.5 million in projected unexpended funding will be transferred from indirect costs that we earn through the department. So one highlight I want to make on all of this, these are projections of unexpended funds. As all of you know, annually the department reverts funding. It's just a normal case of doing business. I think historically the average has been in a roughly $4 billion annual state budget that the department receives, less than 1%, or roughly $38 million, reverts each year. So what we are effectively doing is anticipating that reversion and using those projected unexpended funds that would otherwise be reverted to use those in order to expand the pre-K program in response to the court order. And either it's not moving forward, or I believe I've actually come to the end of the presentation. I'm happy to take questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Secretary, can you give us a little bit more detail on the local contribution with the Title I dollars? I was just concerned number of counties that won't have those funds available to do their matching dollars.
I'll field that question, Representative Grissom. But we, the school systems make those determinations about how Title I dollars are expended. And typically, for quite some time in North Carolina, a portion of Title I dollars have been allocated to pre-K classrooms, even prior to the beginning of MORT 4. And so it is just a normal part of their allocation process. It varies from county to county. In some counties at this point in time for expansion, there was, you know, the were no dollars available in Title I or in exceptional children's programs. In other counties, there were still some dollars that they could blend with our pre-K dollars to serve children.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the high poverty level counties, we feel confident that those dollars will be there and they can participate as well as most other counties, right?
Yes, sir. That's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have the county breakdown yet? Are you working on a county breakdown? I know last year when the governor did the same thing, she had the county breakdown.
We do, Mr. Chairman. We're happy to make that available to you.
Could you provide that to staff so they can have it for the get it for the committee members? Chairman Dollar, did you have? Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would ask how you can make a determination that you have this additional $20 million to commit. Obviously, it's a one-time commitment, right, as it was last year, given that at the end of the fiscal year just a few months ago, we passed a bill in the waning hours that provided additional funds for cash flow because the department needed cash flow in order to finish out the fiscal year and use part of that money. And then, of course, some weeks after the beginning of the new fiscal year, I think it was 40-some million dollars, was there that went back. And in that particular case, it went back to repairs and renovation. So basically, it sounds like to me, I mean, you're spending anticipated reversions when the department has a history over the last several years of having cash flow problems. So are you telling us today that you guarantee, I mean, obviously you're not going to be there, but, I mean, are you guaranteeing to the General Assembly you're not going to be coming back to us to resolve cash flow issues at the end of the fiscal year?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that we have a high degree of confidence that throughout the department we will have excess funds or unspent funds at the end of the year. With regard to the Medicaid budget, I was very pleased at the end of last year that the legislature was able to fund Medicaid at the appropriate levels, and I'm confident that those levels that we will hit that target or come very close on either end of that target. So I think one of the major differences is that we believe the budgeted amount for Medicaid is more appropriate to our level and our entitlement that we're required to meet in the state, so that we should not have the same kinds of cash flow and underfunding problems that we had last year with the Medicaid program. That, in addition to, I think, the improvements that have been made and the savings that have been made in a variety of programs across the department give me certainly a high degree of confidence that we will have that money and that we are able to use that money at this time. The reason that we chose to do this with projected reversions is that kids are only 4 years old once. There is no waiting list for the pre-K program. So if we missed an opportunity to serve these kids, some 5,000 kids in the state, we would have missed that opportunity for the rest of their lives, and so it is imperative that we do this at this time rather than wait another year, because we would lose literally a whole class of kids if we did not do this now.
Well, you've got if the judge had not disallowed the co-pays, you would be much further along in terms of the number of kids served. So isn't it fair to say that the actions of the judge cut slots for these same kids that you have a concern about?
Having not received a law degree from anywhere, I won't hazard an opinion as to what the judge's ruling may have done, but I will say that the judge's order did change the prospective way in which the pre-K program would have been administered prior to the legislative changes that were mandated that were later overturned by the Superior Court. There were no co-pays required in the pre-K program.
But that was a merged program, but you acknowledge the fact that the judge's action did cut funding to the pre-K program and did cut slots, ongoing dollars.
I think certainly, but I think that needed to be balanced out, as I think the judge did, with the impact of that copay on the most at-risk kids that this program was designed to serve. So I think, again, that was the judge's decision. It's a decision that is still being looked at in the court system that was upheld by the appellate court. So we are obliged to follow through with the court order, which, as you know, Chairman Dollar, is the law of the land. And the governor does have that authority in the Executive Budget Act to appropriate funds, or to move funds, rather, for in response to a court order, which is what she has done in Executive Order 128.
Well, I would just, not as a question, but just as an observation, I hope that the Secretary's optimistic view of where we are with the budget holds true, particularly in terms of cash flow at the end of the year, end of the fiscal year. And the other observation I would make is that in looking at those numbers, I do think, and it's the reason why I keep coming back to this, it gets forgotten, Mr. Chairman, that the judge's actions by disallowing people to come in and to do those copays cut money that would be used for having more children eligible, more children in the program, and more slots available.
Senator Nesbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to that last comment, I haven't read the decision in great detail, but any running knowledge of the history of the state knows that we give our public schools to our children, and we don't put up barriers for them to get in. We don't have a poll tax to get you through the door to get an education. And I think the judge's decision was not only appropriate, but very good policy for the state to tell us not to start putting fees on kids to get a basic education. And that's what his rulings and Leandro have been about from the beginning. It is what is required to give a child a basic education. And he's determined that pre-K is absolutely necessary for these children, and when it becomes necessary, it's something the state should provide. You cannot, I know we live in a culture where we want to charge fees, but there are certain places you can't charge fees, and public education is one of them. And I hope we don't try to go down that road again. That was fool's gold to start with. It's punitive to these children, and it would have been detrimental to a number of them, who would have been deterred, or their families would have been, by not having the money to be able to pay the copays.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dollar, Chairman Dollar.
I want to make sure that it's clarified, because it may not be understood. The pre-K program is actually a merger of a couple of programs, and the prior existing program in the Department of Health and Human Services had a scale of fees that were charged. Of people participating. And you can go back to families all over this state that were begging their local center, saying, look, we want to put money in so we can access this program, but the judge's order disallowed that. So he actually cut access to people who had in prior years had been paying to have that access to that early childhood education. And it was, in all cases, being subsidized to various levels depending on what their income was. And that was a part of the state budget for years.
Chairman Dollar, that is correct. Actually, the copay and the rate that we took was a rate that we took out of the budget passed by the former majority, Senator Nesbitt and others, that was an 8-10% copay for those on subsidy, those in the 4- and 5-star pre-K program, and it was simply bringing those up to the same level so that they were equal per se, and we would be able to serve more kids. And we really took the model that was put in place for charging that 8-10% copay, which had been in place for years under the former majority. So this was actually an idea that we took from the past budgets. Further questions? Senator Nesbitt?
Just a brief comment on that. When these programs were started, they were kind of spinoffs from daycare. Daycare is not public education, and it doesn't live under the same constitutional requirements as public education. What this judge has done consistently in Leandro is tell us what is required under the free public education for our children, and he determined for these children that a pre-K program properly funded for them was necessary. Once you do that and you move it into the educational realm and you make it part of what's required to educate a child, you can't charge fees anymore. You can charge fees for daycare. We do that every day. And we have subsidized daycare programs. But these programs fundamentally change with the judge's order.
Well, you are right about one thing, Senator Nesbitt. It was daycare under the previous majority, and this majority has made an effort to change that from just funding daycare to making sure that the good quality and the positive outcomes that we see through more at four and through now pre-K, that we see those in the other through the subsidy program, which is why we went and changed the law and said no longer can a low-quality, low-star-rated facility receive, quote-unquote, the daycare money, as you put it, but they've got to have that 3, 4, 5, that higher-quality education. They've got to fall in line with the old Mort 4 curriculum, and they've got to meet those high standards so that the taxpayers' dollars aren't just going to babysit a child, but they're going to help improve their education through the early childhood education experience that they get with that high quality through the old Mort 4 now pre-K program. So yes, you're right. It was a babysitting dollars, but now it's not. And because we improved the quality of it, it was appropriate to make sure that they were both at the same level. And since your 4 and 5 star pre-K programs were basically the same thing as the old Mort 4, the current pre-K, it was appropriate to make sure that they were equal, per se, and that you were getting the same early childhood education in both, so therefore it's appropriate for them both to have the same requirements to be admitted to, and to make sure that because you had to pay that 8 to 10% copay through subsidy, that you didn't have folks that were receiving that on this massive waiting list to get into a program where they didn't have to, which is a lot of what the waiting list comes from, is folks that may be paying that 8 to 10%, but they wanted to get to where they didn't have to pay that 8 to 10%. And there were still exemptions to make sure that folks that might could not pay that amount could qualify for the services. So in essence, our efforts to improve early childhood education in this state were set back by Judge Manning's ruling and what he did.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I did want
to clarify.
Thank you. I did want to clarify a couple of things. One, I think you are in making the characterization of daycare versus early education. I think it's important to note that initially, when the subsidy program was begun, the goal was really to allow for parents to have the opportunity to go back to work or go to school, and so a safe and secure place for their children to be from birth to 12 was one of the goals of the subsidy program. And in that program, there was, always has been and continues to this day, a copay requirement varies from about 8% to 10% depending on family income. And I think Chairman Dollar is absolutely accurate in that the two programs, the pre-K or Mort 4 program, was indeed merged into the Department of Health and Human Services Division of Early Childhood. But the two programs remain separate in terms of administration and eligibility requirements and so forth. So although one is a subsidy program that has, I think you accurately described, evolved to more of an early education program rather than a babysitting service, which is, I think, is terrific, is the way that the state ought to go. The pre-K program remains an education program for four-year-olds in preparation for kindergarten and education in the years that follow. So I think there are some important distinctions between the two programs, and we remain committed to providing those services both in the subsidy program and in the pre-K program.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary D'Elia, I wanted to know, could you have a, do you have a breakdown on the new, the, I guess, I don't know if we're calling them new kids or, but the additional slots, the breakdown between, you mentioned small businesses, but also public schools also provide pre-K. Do you have a percentage breakdown? Like, are they 100% small business? Because I don't think they are. And so I don't know if you have a breakdown.
Representative, we do have a breakdown, and I will go back to the slides, but in categorically where those numbers are. And there, that's the breakdown. You're correct. Not all of the child care centers are small businesses, and we can certainly provide you the breakdown of which of those are for-profit small businesses, which of them may be nonprofit, which of those may be affiliated with a faith organization, and we're happy to do that. Okay.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Direct this compliment to Secretary D'Elia. I applaud your success in turning over all the seat cushions to find this money. I'm going to go off topic just a tad bit here. We're facing a significant issue with our group home residents. I've not been privy to any background discussions or whatever. Can you update me on where we are with that at the moment?
Sure. It continues to be a concern of the department. It is something that just as recently as this morning, I had a conversation with the chairs about ways that we may be able to try to resolve that. I think the dilemma that we have in the department is that we believe that that was considered by the General Assembly and there was a specific decision made to fund the $39.7 million in the budget only for adult care homes, not for other purposes, which ties our hands. The question has been raised as to why it is that we are not able to identify other funds to appropriate to support the group homes. There are really two reasons. One is we believe that the legislature's budget decisions really tie our hands in being able to increase or appropriate funding for something that the legislature did not appropriate. And two is that with the pre-K program, that is in response to a court order, which the Executive Budget Act specifically gives the governor authority to find funding to meet the requirements of a court order. With the group homes, we're under no such court order, so she does not have the extraordinary power to do that.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
I may be wrong on my understanding of this, but the $39.7 million that we funded in the budget wasn't for group homes. It was for people.
That is correct, but the language in that budget act specifically said, I believe the word was only to be paid for adult care homes.
Another follow-up.
Go ahead.
I noticed in your turning the seat cushions over that you went to a very large spectrum of pots of money. And just as somebody that's very concerned about the people in this state, particularly this group we're talking about, find another seat cushion.
Further questions from members? On the executive order? All right. If not, thank you, Ms. Cassidy. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. At this time, we're going to move to the third item on your agenda, and that is a Medicaid budget status report from Chloe.
Good morning. I'm just going to give a brief overview of the Medicaid budget, what it looks like today compared to the department's forecast and compared to the same point last year. And then the department will give more detail on the forecast and on the details of what they're seeing so far. Looking first at last year's budget, we began last year, FY11-12, July certified budget, general fund appropriation of about $2.96 million. But at the end of the fiscal year, OSBM had a reported gap of $375 million, which was a combination of some one-time expenditures and some and some ongoing issues. In addition, the department paid the pays drug rebates back to the federal government. The department receives the rebates in and then pays the federal government back their piece of the rebate for the June rebates. The department actually paid those back to the federal government in July. So if those had been paid in June, that would have been another $100+ million that would have needed to have been covered with general fund appropriation. The actual amount of the June payment was about $133 million, but a piece of that would have been paid in July anyway for those rebates that came in at the very end of June. So if you take those two things together, the gap and the drug rebate liability, you have a total gap of about $508 million, which brings the total for the year from that 2.96 up to $3.47 billion in general fund monies. Comparing that to this year's certified budget, this year's certified budget is $3.1 million. If you look at the difference between last year's total of the 3.47 and this year's 3.1, you have a difference of about $365 million. So looking at where we are so far this year, the green line that you'll see on all of these slides is the department's forecast, and then the dark red line is actual year-to-date. This first slide is total expenditures, general fund, federal money, all total expenditures, and you can see we're actually running a little bit under forecast. That difference is about $60 million, about 1.4% under forecast. Compared to last year, we're also running a little bit under where it was for last year. And you can see that orange line is the FY11-12 actual expenditures. Looking at the other piece, which is receipts, we see that receipts are also running a little bit under forecast. The forecast, again, is the green line, and the dark red is year-to-date actual. We're running about $144 million below where the department had forecast receipts through the end of October, a difference of about 4.7%. The department has said that some of this, a portion of this, is due to timing, and I believe they'll be talking more about that as well. Compared to last year, we're also running just a little bit under, about the same amount under where we were last year at the same point of time in terms of receipts. So the combination of being a little bit under in expenditures, a little bit more under in revenue, means that we're a little bit over forecast in actual year-to-date appropriations. You can see it's a difference of about $83 million more than was forecasted, or about 6.9% more than was forecasted. If you compare that to last year's actuals, you can see that orange line, we're actually running closer to that orange line of FY11-12 actual than we are to the green forecast for this year, but still under that orange line. You'll see that difference of at the end of the bright red line that goes up at FY11-12 actual. That's where the shortfall was filled in, and you can see that the green forecast is running in between the certified budget for last year and the actual, including the forecast. And that total difference there is, again, the $500 million. So just moving forward, this is something we want to keep an eye on. Some of the questions we have for the department, just kind of going forward, things we'll be talking to the department with, we're talking with them about weekly, and just keeping an eye on all of these things. Some of our questions are how has the 12-13 forecast, that green line, how has it been adjusted to account for the experience in FY11-12, the orange line and that bright red, and the difference there that may have been recurring. The drug rebates that were paid in July rather than in June, is that something the department anticipates doing again this year? If so, and if the General Assembly prefers that they pay them in June, then that you'll need to look at that as an issue. And then what are the impacts of the implementation delays and any court actions on the 12-13 forecast going forward? So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Chairman Dollar?
Yeah, this is... And Ms. Gossage, it's not necessarily a question for you, but if you want to chime in when I'm finished, that'd be fine. The drug rebate issue actually began, and somebody correct me if I have my timing wrong on this, but as I recall, that was at the end of the 08-09 fiscal year in preparation for the 10-11 or the 10-12 biennial budget. And the decision was made, I believe it was in 09, to shift that drug payment from June to July. And by doing that, you make it in that current fiscal year, they only had 11 payments, because those are monthly payments. You shift it to the next fiscal year. When shifting it to the next fiscal year, you create an issue where you may have, if you were to actually pay it in that fiscal year, you'd be paying, making 13 payments. Obviously, at the end of the 09-10 year, they didn't, and they may have started in 09-10, but anyway, they didn't make that payment. They just kicked it again over to the next one. And so it's been kicked over at least a couple of years, if not 3 years, but at least 2 years that I'm aware of. And I wouldn't think there would be any reason, just in my opinion, I wouldn't think there'd be any reason why we wouldn't continue to kick that 13th payment. I mean, now that the rug was shorted, you really don't have much choice unless you want to come up with $132 million basically for nothing, rather than shifting it over into the next fiscal year until some maybe happy day when we've got all kinds of money around here and we can fix an anomaly, because essentially it's an anomaly. It was an anomaly that was created for a particular purpose, and I don't criticize the past majority here in the General Assembly for having done it. It was expedient at the time, but that's what the decision was, and it has been continued the last these two fiscal years, because no one, the extra $132 million wasn't there to fix an anomaly.
Yes, sir, Chairman Dollar. It's my understanding that this began in fiscal year 9-10.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to go back maybe and get a little bit. I'm over to your right here. If you could talk a little bit more about the significance of the difference in the actual and projected expenditures and receipts on your, it's basically pages 2 and 3 on our handout. But when you look at these graphs, you make it look like that they're just about the same, but I guess I would just point out that the difference is about $84.4 million. And when you talk about receipts being down 4.7% versus expenditures being down at 1.4%, that's about 3.5 times as much. So to me, that seems rather significant, and perhaps you could expand on that a little bit.
Yes, sir. Representative Jones, Chairman Burr. The difference here, let's get that, the difference in expenditures being slightly down at 1.4% and then the receipts at 4.7%, that does mean that there is going to be a net impact on increased appropriations. You're actually going to see it show up more in appropriations because Medicaid has more federal money than state money. So a small impact on the federal side is going to mean a bigger percentage impact on the state side. And that's how you end up with the $83 million being actually almost a 7% increase over the forecast. The department has indicated that some of that is due to timing on receipts. I think at least $33 million of it is not due to timing. So again, that is a significant piece, and it looks and is more significant on the state expenditure side than on the federal side as a percentage. Yes, sir.
Additional questions from members? All right. Thank you, Chloe. This time we'll hear from Steve Owen to get a Medicaid budget update from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Maybe I'll just take a moment before I jump into my presentation and go through a couple of the questions that Chloe raised and give you some general information. In terms of how the 2013 forecast or budget was adjusted relative to our experience in 2012, a number of the one-time items, really the one-time liability items that were not included that created portions of our shortfall in 2012, were included in our 2013 budget. Additionally, the issues that were structural as it relates to 2012 in terms of budget, as we did the rebase, those got taken into consideration. Issues around how federal mandates and cost increases were handled in the original budget, how enrollment, consumption, and so forth, all those were built into the budget in terms of our rebase, as well as those areas where we didn't achieve or were unable to achieve reductions during 2013. The rebase actually pushed those through in terms of adjustments in our base expenditure line. We did, in fact, the way we did our 2013 budget, assume that we would handle rebates during 2013 the same as we did in 2012. Those would have 12 monthly payments this year. That line also, the $132 million, is a combination of both rebates and what's called undispositioned receipts, which relate to other types of amounts we receive that typically we pay those monies back to the federal government in the month following receipt after we identify exactly what those receipts are. And finally, in terms of how any implementation delays or other factors may affect the forecast I'm going to go through in a minute, we've tried to consider any of the things that we know about in terms of delays, such as the implementation with MCOs. Those have been built into our rebase, as well as everything we know about consumption, as well as enrollment. As Chloe said, we are working weekly with fiscal research to make sure we're together in terms of everybody understands all the assumptions that are built into these forecast, and we'll continue to do that. So again, what I want to do is spend a little bit of time and talk about kind of where we are today, and talk about where our cash position is, go back through enrollment and utilization, expenditure trends, talk about CC&C since that's a big savings component of our 2013 budget, and then give you some sense of where our overall 13 forecast is. As we get into cash, and I think the lines that Chloe show up there, the forecast line is really our current, is really a new item for us where we actually forecast on a weekly basis where we think our expenditures will be. So there's a lot of assumptions built into that around enrollment, when certain things like savings initiatives will actually be achieved, when things like rebates will be received. Since those are quarterly billings and we actually receive those monies, not consistently through the year, but sporadically through the year, and when those monies gets paid back to the federal government or to CMS. So this year, when we look at our current, our cash position, our cash forecast, the lines that Chloe showed really reflect that monthly assumptions or the set of weekly assumptions that we built under our forecast. As Chloe mentioned, when you look at our cash position through Friday, November 2nd, it's about $33.5 million that is really unrelated to timing. That timing difference between the 82 that Chloe mentioned and the 33 I've got here, about $50 million, relates to when we actually received rebates. The weekly assumptions that were built into our spread assume we would see receive rebates from the billings that occurred back in September and October, and those monies would be paid back in November. What actually happened is those rebates began to come in September. We actually repaid those in October, so we paid back the federal portion sooner than we'd expected. So if you break down the $33 million that we believe is what we're trying to focus on in terms of where we are against our forecast, it falls into four categories. The first one is claims, which we estimate about $26 million. In terms of cash right now, we're short there. Administration and contracts, about 3.7. Program integrity, we're actually ahead of budget, about $500,000 there. For settlements, our gap plan and other payments and receipts, about $4.4 million. This represents about a 1.1% variance, at least for the whole year. And I want to, I guess, take a moment again just to reemphasize what we're comparing against is a weekly spread. We're using history. We're using a lot of assumptions to build that. And we've tried to resist just changing our weekly spread based on as we learn new things to really give us some ability to try to go in and understand what the variances are and try to analyze what our expenditures are doing. As you'll see in a minute, based on our full-year forecast, that $26 million is going to come down substantially. In fact, what you're going to see is that we believe that the timing issues we saw in October will make those up through the course of this year. Enrollment. Where are we this in terms of overall enrollment in Medicaid? As we reported last month, we're actually a little bit higher in terms of our average enrollment being less than budgeted, but almost 8,300 people less enrolled in Medicaid this year on an average basis than we expected. Obviously, that creates a positive variance. Offsetting that, and actually more than offsetting that, is the fact that we've seen the distribution or the mix of our enrolled recipients changing. This year, we've seen less children enrolled. We've seen much higher disabled. And then in October, we actually saw our AFDC population over 21 reflected a spike. How that plays out in terms of enrollment, what I've shown here are really three things. Again, the graph on the left is the same graph we looked at last month with the addition of October. You can see that the blue line, which is our actual expenses, is coming closer to our red line, which is the budget, but is still substantially under where we actually anticipated we would be at this point. The chart in the bottom right-hand corner shows the actual enrollment in terms of population at the end of October and where we see the variation. And this is a point-in-time comparison. So you can see that our ABD population is about 1,500 more individuals, but the bulk of that really is in our disabled population, whereas our children are running about 8,000 less. The significance when you start looking at expenditures is really the chart in red in the right-hand corner. Our ABD population, we spend about $1,400 a month on. Our children, we spend about $224 a month on. So obviously that variation, as we see more of those individuals enrolled in Medicaid as a proportion of our total, we're going to see our expenditure variances reflect that. I want to give you some sense of how we've trended over time. This is our Medicaid enrollment for those same populations. And really going back to 2009 and showed you where we have actually been in terms of total enrolled population, as well as where our percentage of our population or our enrollment has been distributed based on these four different groupings. As you can see, in each year, every group really has increased in terms of total population. However, the proportion of children, particularly through 2012, has grown substantially each year. So we have had more children each year. This year, while we still have more children than we did last year, they've not grown as quickly as they did in 2010 and 11. When we look at expenses, one of the things, it's hard to look at Medicaid as a one single number and try to figure out where we're at. So we really try to break apart our expenditures in two slices. The first one is trying to break down our expenditures by what's called aid categories or program aid categories. And we try to look at, again, three distinct groupings, our age-blind, disabled, our children, and then the other populations. And I've given you some indication of who's in those populations. We also look at service groupings. Service groupings really are intended to try to break apart the expenditures into types of services, types of providers. So what we call foundation services include our physicians, our drugs, our dental expenses, transportation, those type expenses. Our medical expenses, primarily our hospital services, as well as diagnostic and treatment services in non-hospital settings. Our long-term or residential services, our nursing homes and PCS services, behavioral. Again, I won't read those to you, but really try to, these are the way we try to componentize our expenses to try to make sure that we can identify where we have variances and help us take action in terms of where we might be able to influence or change the spending patterns. Using these categories, what I've tried to do is give you some sense of how our expenditures have changed over time. The first slide here has got a lot of information on it, and this is our ABD population. So what you can see, for instance, in the chart on the left top, it shows you how much we have spent for foundation services for the ABD population for 2009 through 2013. As you can see in our foundation services, again, which is physicians, drugs, transportation and dental, we've seen a decline of about $7 per member per month in that category. Really, all of our categories in this, or all of our expense categories in ABD have declined during 2013 with the exception of our behavioral. As we've gone back and looked at that information, as we implement new MCOs, there's a phenomenon called claims lag, which basically during the first 2 to 3 months after you implement an MCO, we still have claims coming in for services prior to that, as well as we're paying the capitation rates. So we have that's affecting, I think, our claim, our behavioral health expenses on a PMPM basis. The second chart shows you what percentage of the PMPM has been reflected in each of the expense categories, and the two charts on the right really just give you some trend lines. This is the same information for children. Again, this would be at least the vast majority of our enrolled population. We've actually seen our PMPM decline by $8, almost $8.50 in 2013. The big drop in 2011, when you look at children, as well as in other categories, but particularly in children, is really attributable to a couple of things. One is we had a rate increase that we did in 2010, that the annualized effect was actually realized in 11. We also saw decreased utilization for both physicians and hospital inpatient ER services. Our drug costs also came down and primarily reflected the fact that our generic utilization was increasing during that period of time fairly rapidly as a result of some of the policies we put into place. And finally, this is, again, just the same chart showing for the other populations. CC&C, in our 2013 budget, there's $149 million of state savings planned for in the budget process. What I'm going to do is give you some perspective of over time, based on the actual report that was published back in December of 2011 that Milliman prepared for us, looking at CC&C savings, how the overall savings in the various categories have been accumulated over the course of those 4 years that were studied back then, which was 2007 through 2010. The one thing I want to point out here is when you look at ABD, you see we actually in 2007, 8, and 9 were spending more money on those individuals that were in CC&C that were ABD population than we actually were saving. That really reflects the fact that in that population in particular, as they're added into the CC&C network in usually early 6 to 8 months, what you'll see is expenditures will rise as individuals come in. They see their physicians. They get tested. They get their medications regulated and get on to appropriate medications and appropriate other treatment. So the early months, we actually see increased expenses, and over time, what we see is the cost of other services decreasing for that population. Again, this is how that original 149 was broken down between ABD, non-ABD, and then the other initiatives. And where we stand right now, through October, the first 4 months of 2013, we're about $4.9 million less than we expected. If you remember last month, we had actually shown y'all about a $7.5 million variance in terms of being behind. So we made up about $2.6 million, or CC&C made up about $2.6 million during the month. We still have an issue in terms of where our ABD population, in terms of their enrollment. We did see a slight increase beginning in October. We're up to around 70% of that population is rolled up from about 69.1%. The areas where we're still working in terms of looking at the variation between where we thought we would be on expenses really is focused in primarily in hospital emergency services as well as drugs. When you look at these together, they account for about $6.3 million variation in expenses. CC&C and DMA are now working together. There's actually a task force that's been formed to look at emergency service expenditures to understand what are the trends, determine what initiatives are impacting expenses, and what are the things that we can do relative to the spending for emergency services. The 2013 forecast. What we've done at this point, we've actually gone in and updated our SAS forecast, which helps us with our enrollment. We've used our current PMPMs as our foundation and made appropriate adjustments to reflect annualization of impacted annualized impact of those things that were budgeted last year that got started that have full year impact this year. We've also blended in our most current information around how consumption is changing, how federal mandates and cost changes are affecting our expenses to try to understand or really put together a forecast for 13. What we look like right now in terms of our annual forecast based on all these assumptions is that we believe that we'll end the year around $11.5 million in appropriations less than we have actually have budgeted for this year. So really pretty much right on budget in terms of expenses. We also looked at our non-claims expense. This slide really talks about our claims expenses. When you add our before I go to that, we tried to break apart what's causing the $11.5 million in terms of state appropriation. If you remember earlier, I talked about the difference in our mix of enrollment, the fact that we have more disabled and more AFDC compared to children. That is actually affecting, in terms of our total spending this year, about $113 million. That alone would drive about $113 million of total expense into the Medicaid budget, of which the state would have about $23 million of expense. The fact that we have less people overall actually dampens that, but you can see the net of the two, we actually, in terms of total expenses, are spending more than we had would have spent. In terms of our mix of enrollment, we're actually pretty close to the same or breaking even, so that we're not getting the benefit, or the full benefit, of having less people enrolled. Consumption this year, which this is the first time I think I've seen this in the last 3 years, our consumption and mix variances are fairly close to or fairly nominal. In prior years, we were seeing this as high as 4% and 5%. Again, when we look at our total expenses and you add the claims together, we think right now, based on everything that we know, that we believe our total expenses will come in fairly close to where, or at or below, where our state appropriations are for overall Medicaid spending. One of the things that we've tried to do this year, and we believe that part of the process of managing these expenditures is really having some system in place where we can identify deviations from what we thought would happen and help guide us to take appropriate actions to correct those where we can. We've enhanced the reporting and monitoring processes to really try to expedite how quickly we can identify variations and how quickly we can identify trends to help lead us to do things like the collaboration between DMA and CCNC on the savings around care management. In fact, the Hospital Association has also reached out, and we're meeting this week, on that same issue to try to engage them in terms of, or they're engaging us, either whichever way you want to look at it, to really understand what those expenses are, how they're changing, and where we might have opportunities to further enhance those savings. And finally, I think, as I said earlier, when you look at overall spending, we believe we're fairly close to budget, and based on everything we know now, should end up fairly close to the end of the year. Before I go into questions, there is data in what's called the data book behind this that I'm not planning to go through unless you have quite specific questions, but it should provide you some additional information to help support some of the information we've put forth. At this point, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Chairman Pate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Owens, on slide 13, you indicated there at the bottom of the slide that CCNC and DMA are working together to review the emergency service expenditures. What strategies and information has come forward from that, if you would, please?
So far, most of the work has been around data gathering. We're trying to look at one of the phenomena with emergency room utilization. You've got folks that come in and they use the emergency room as needed. You have others that are frequent users of the emergency room. We're trying to separate those two populations, number one. The second issue is we're trying to break apart utilization not only from a state perspective, in other words, what proportion of our population is using that, but also what are the variations between counties? Because there are some fairly significant variations from county to county, to see if there are some either opportunities that certain counties may be deploying or utilizing that we've seen less usage of the ER, or those that we may have some opportunity. We're also trying to break across apart the cost component, because that's a significant piece. In other words, for the people that go to the ER, are they actually consuming more imaging services or more other non-treatment services in the ER when they're there? So right now we're still in the data gathering, but out of this we've included not just the bean counters but also the clinicians and others to help try to translate this into specific things or initiatives that can help lower that cost.
Follow-up?
Thank you for that. Do you have you seen any evidence that emergency room expenses vary by different hospitals, for instance, in addition to different locations?
The payment methodology for hospital emergency room services is that we pay 80% of cost. So the cost specific to that hospital, we pay a cost, a percentage of that. So you'll see some variation from hospital to hospital based on how their expenses, their cost base, how their mix of services are. So you do see some differences there, which that's one of the things we're trying to break apart in terms of our data. How much can we isolate? Is there a variation from hospital to hospital based on cost?
Chairman Dollar?
Just sort of following up on Chairman Pate's question, because you would agree or may not agree that your overall component of the expenses is a factor of the utilization as well as the cost of a particular type of procedure. So I'm assuming from what you're saying, Mr. Owen, that what you're looking at, what y'all are trying to get at, is both where we're moving in terms of utilization as it may affect, for example, emergency room, as well as if there are particular elements there in which the cost of a given service has increased.
Yeah, that's correct. And I might add one little nuance to I think what you asked me. The three components are utilization. There's how frequently people are using or how intensely people are using the service. The second one is what services they receive when they're in the emergency department. And the third piece is what the cost is. So we're trying to separate those three because clearly CC&C has influence over utilization. And hopefully, through providing information, we can have some impact over the services that are actually provided. The cost piece is a separate conversation.
Thank you. And one other just general question. What would be the impact? I want to get back to it because I've asked you this every month in terms of getting the ABD population up. And I think y'all had contracted again with, I think it's PCG, to put the procedure that you put in place last winter to up the ABD population back into operation. And so I guess my question is, if my understanding is correct, that's been in operation for at least several weeks now, or a month or so, or more. But it sounds like we've only moved from around 68, 69 to 70. Is there some impediment that's keeping us from moving up to the 75% enrollment of ABD, which is what the target for this year is supposed to be?
We engaged PCG to begin what was called auto-enrollment. That began on the 15th of October. So what you have here really is 2 weeks' worth of information in terms of the enrollment from 69.9 to 70%. The other thing that we did about the same time was to re-engage or rehire staff or temporary staff to help us with, as people call in to basically to request not to be assigned to a CC&C physician, to really talk them through the process. What does it mean in terms of help them understand the benefits and help them help us understand what the issue is that they may have around being assigned to a particular physician.
Well, let me follow up on that. Just ask you, what sort of timetable would you anticipate now that you've got those processes back underway, moving the needle substantially toward between where we're at now at 70 to 75, because obviously there's a, you know, there's a big difference there in terms of getting to some of our goals by reaching that.
If I look at history or when we did this before, I mean, I would anticipate that in January we should be back, we should be up to where we had planned to be if the trend lines that we saw experienced last year when we first put this into place are consistent with this year.
Thank you.
Senator Heiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the areas looking at and seeing the original report that's kind of saying an $87 million shortfall, and then you're estimating about $50 million of that or more is a timing issue. We have several items that are in the budget that are, I guess we would say, conditional funding based on the status of this on January 1 and a certification from OSBM. Would it be your opinion at this point that all of that $50 million would have to work its way out in timing, and we would have to also make up the additional $30 million between now and the 1st of January before any of those conditional spendings would be allowed or would be certified by OSBM?
In terms of the $50 million, the specific issue there is that when we received the rebates in basically a month earlier than we planned to, we actually then had to pay the CMS back a month earlier. So we expect that $50 million will work itself out in the month of November. In fact, I believe the 19th was when we originally had expected to have to pay that back. So I would expect that piece will go away fairly quickly. The $33 million, again, is going to work itself out through the course of the year, which is one of the reasons I want to spend some time with Susan and Chloe to make sure they understand all the assumptions that are built into that, and we can revisit how that spread was done so they can see that variation.
Follow-up. What I was trying to drive at, though, is that we have triggers in the budget that require the budget status as of January 1st. Is there any indication that these will be worked out by January 1st so that the state budget office could certify that we are on target for our budget on January 1st for these conditional spending items?
Our forecast is an annual one, so I have not actually done a month-by-month restatement of our forecast. I'd be happy to try to do that so that we can understand the fact there's decisions that are keyed around this particular our status. I think that's something I can work with fiscal research to make sure we have that kind of that level of detail so that we understand.
Okay. And then one final question, just one, and I think we're going to hear more in a second. What is your expectation for the delays in the LME conversions overall towards the budget implications? I know that there was a lot, $50 million or more implicated on the fact that we were at full conversion on January 1st. That's not the indication we're hearing now. So kind of where do you suspect those additional costs will, how much are you expecting those costs to be?
Based on the LMEs that I've been told, at least the decision has been made that those will be delayed. I believe it's about a $2 million effect in 2013. The average, and we've actually got this, I don't have it with me, we actually have the average, what a 30-day delay means in terms of an LME. The average for the whole state is around $750,000 per 30 days. So, and like I said, I've got it specific to each LME. So as I get additional information that other LMEs would be delayed, that'll be factored into our forecast, and we'll actually restate the forecast. So right now what I've got are those that I know that at least we've granted a delay to.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Owen, on page 3, or slide 3, rather, when you talked about the cash shortfall, you showed program integrity net recoveries of $500,000. I'm assuming that's the fraud program that we're working with.
It's a combination of our
fraud, waste, and abuse, as well as our third-party recovery.
Follow-up. Could you tell me what the expectations are in terms of the fraud? Because we hear some huge numbers as far as the percentage of fraud within Medicaid, and what kind of recovery are you looking at long-term?
Yeah, I don't have that with me. I can be happy to get that for you. The majority, though, of what we typically recover in a year is in our third-party recovery area. But I'll be happy to get you actually what we have in the budget and what we've seen the last couple of years in terms of both fraud, waste, and abuse versus third-party.
Follow-up. What is your procedure for following up on complaints, or do you do any type of spot checking on your own? Since we know that Medicaid has this issue, do you do any type of in-house searching and follow-up on like complaints or people calling in anonymously and that type of stuff?
Yes, we do follow up. I mean, we get a number of calls, I mean, for a variety of reasons. When we get those calls, regardless of what the issue is, we actually do try to follow up internally.
Just to make an additional comment on a couple of things, we do have a hotline for fraud, waste, and abuse that gets used regularly. We're also working with IBM around an analytic technology that allows you to run different types of providers through the model and identify those who are outliers in one way or another that lets you focus your efforts in looking at potential areas of fraud and abuse. What we're doing with IBM is developing and putting online a module that is specific to each type of provider. So it might be behavioral health, or it might be durable medical equipment, but gradually those modules are coming online and allow you to look at each provider and identify those that require additional scrutiny.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
How long has that been in operation, and what type of results are you seeing?
Just one other, I guess, point of clarification. We are also federally required to follow up on those complaints, and I believe we've had these other processes Mike was talking about in for about a year.
Mr. Chairman,
if I can
follow up on Representative Avila's question, what we have done, we have had those analytics systems in place for about a year. We began with what we believe to be the areas that were more fraught with abuse, potential abuse. The first component that we evaluated was outpatient behavioral health. We are going to be rolling out an analytics on durable medical equipment, which we also think may be ripe for some fraud and abuse. On outpatient behavioral health, we've identified up to $191 million in potential fraud, and we are working very actively with the Attorney General to make referrals of those cases that we believe were indeed fraud for the Attorney General to review and determine whether there's a criminal investigation that ought to be appropriate. I will tell you, Representative Avila, that we have had, as a result of that data analytics, we have had the highest number of referrals for potential criminal investigation that we've made to the Attorney General, and they have accepted the highest number historically of those cases for investigation. So we're at the beginning of that process. I think the results thus far are very encouraging. But I will caution very quickly is that the identification of $191 million in potential fraud does not mean that we will recover $191 million. A lot of these folks disappear. A lot of these folks have spent the money if indeed there was any kind of fraud. So it will be some time before we are able to determine how much of that money, if indeed it is fraud, we'll be able to recover.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Owen, are you going to go over the data book in the back of this, or is that something?
I was intending for that to be as information for you. I'm happy to go through any of that you'd like to.
Okay. On page six, if I might, Mr. Chairman, in your data book, you've got enrollment utilization expenditure trends, and some of those are very surprising to me. If you, especially the decreases, I know the dental services had indicated a 17% decrease. Could you maybe give us some insight into how and why these decreases, maybe just some information if you could?
Part of it, I can give you some general information. This is the kind of information we're digging into right now. Part of it, for instance, when you look back against 2012, in 2013, as an example, we have basically the full year impact of rate reductions. While we did it last year, we basically had a month we didn't get it. So that's part of the issue. You also see cost is not necessarily what we pay, but the overall cost per recipient. So that if we're seeing less utilization in terms of expenditures, we'll see less cost.
And the inpatient hospital also, there's a decrease in physician services, and that's very surprising to me.
Again, I think what you're seeing, I mean, mix of services will affect the total expenses. As an example, in hospital, one of the things we have seen as a proportion of our total activity, we have seen a lower proportion of our inpatient hospital going toward maternity care. So what you'll see there is we have lower average cost of admissions. With physicians, again, as we've seen more physicians within CCNC take on patients, we're seeing a different mix of specialists versus primary care physicians. So I think what you're seeing is a combination of mix, policy change, as well as utilization.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. That certainly helps. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Further questions for members on this? All right. If not, thank you, Mr. Owen.
Thank you.
All right. It's the first time I think I will ever be able to say this in this committee. We're actually ahead of schedule. And at this time, we will break and we'll be back. We'll come back at about 10 until 1. This time we're going to move on to the fifth item on our agenda, which is the 1915 BC waiver update. And we're going to hear from Kelly Crosby from DMA. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kelly Crosby. I'm the chief of the Behavioral Health Policy Section at the Division of Medical Assistance. And I'm here to give you an update on the 1915 BC waiver expansion. I have a two-part update. The first is on the status of the LME conversion to MCOs in the Mercer readiness reviews. And the second portion is an update on the Innovations Plus program under the 1915 C waiver. As I mentioned last time, we have 56 counties now under the BC waiver. Cardinal Innovations, formerly known as PBH, Western Highlands Network, ECBH, and Smoky Mountain Center. On December 1st of this year, Sand Hill Center will begin their operations under the waiver. They had a very successful visit at the end of October. Guilford County will be joining Sand Hill Center in April of 2013. That's when their managed care operations will go live. Here's our readiness review schedule. Last week, the 60-day pre-go-live readiness review started. So last week, we were at Partners Behavioral Health Management and Alliance Behavioral Healthcare. Today, the team from Mercer and DHHS are at CenterPoint Human Services, and we will be at East Point at the end of the week. Those four LME MCOs are anticipated to go live January 1st. That was their schedule. The next two LMEs, Coastal Care and MechLink, were projected to go live February 1st, 2013. That's why you will see two readiness review dates for them. They'll both be, have a readiness review at the end of November and then a final one in December. And at that point, the secretary will be able to determine if they're ready to go live by the end of the year. I would like to point out, though, that as Mercer does the reviews, they are sending information to us on the status of how things are progressing. As we get reports from Mercer, we are meeting with the MCOs to determine their final start dates based on the progress that they're making and how much they still have to accomplish by the January 1 and February 1 start dates. As mentioned last month, the department has issued a final start date of February 1st, 2013. If an LME is not prepared to go live February 1st, 2013, DHHS will transition the MCO functions to another LME as per legislation. The department and Mercer have studied and identified several contingency plans for any LME area that is not prepared to go live February 1st, 2013. Last month, we also reported that Mercer was back on site at Western Highlands Network to do an audit of their entire program. This is a summary, a very high-level summary of the report and also progress to date since Mercer was on site. By and large, the Mercer report reported that Western Highlands needed stronger financial management staff and reporting structures. They needed to update their claims and IT system. And they could benefit from organizational training around operating a managed care organization. You'll note the items that say the progress that has happened at Western Highlands. They have hired a managed consultant team. They have completed a needs assessment. They have completed a work plan, and they have updated all the financial reporting for Western Highlands. They are in the midst of completing or initiating an RFP process for a new claim system. Their finances are improving, and their financial reporting has been updated, as I mentioned, by the consulting group. The department does have a weekly plan of correction call with Western Highlands to go through the deficiencies or the areas for improvement noted in the Mercer report. The DMA audit section has also begun an audit of Western Highlands. They are doing the desk review and will do an on-site review this month. In addition, the department will be meeting with Western Highlands and their board to discuss the progress that they are making and any contingency planning if needed. This is the update on the Innovations Plus. As you recall, Innovations is the 1915 C waiver. It is a waiver that allows for services and supports for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to live in the community as opposed to institutional settings. You will see that I've noted some citations from Session Law 2011 that does instruct the department to look at an aggregate funding system, to look at a reliable assessment tool that determines the need of the individuals on the C waiver in order to help allocate resources to those individuals. This is progress on what is happening. As I mentioned 2 months ago, phase one starts with all individuals on the C waiver taking part in an assessment called the Supports Intensity Scale. As I mentioned, it is a reliable and valid instrument. It is currently being used in 17 other states. The goal is to have an assessment that actually identifies the service and support needs of an individual in order to assist with planning, so we know what kind of services and supports the individual may benefit from. Here's an update on that phase. Assessments have begun across the state. The LME MCOs have trained staff that are doing those, as well as a vendor, AAIDD. They are doing the assessments across the state as well. So far, approximately 400 assessments have been completed. The assessments just began in September. In addition, each MCO area had 2 to 3 community trainings on what the supports intensity scale is, what the assessment is like, what families can expect. And from those trainings, each MCO has developed an ongoing stakeholder group. As I mentioned, as individuals do get their supports intensity scale assessment results, they can use those results for planning purposes. Phase two, then, is to take a representative sample of those assessments to develop a resource allocation model for everyone on that innovations waiver. This will be developed by Human Services Research Institute, that's HSRI. Each person will be then be given an individualized budget amount based on the scores from their assessment, as well as other factors such as where they live. And once that sample size finishes their assessments, we anticipate planning and implementation of this resource allocation model between May and July of 2013. So here's the update on that phase. HSRI has already prepared training materials and FAQs on SIS and resource allocation. DMA is updating their website as well as the MCOs. HSRI did present at our DWAC. If you remember what the DWAC is, it is our Departmental Waiver Advisory Committee. They did present on the model and their plans for the model in 2013. And beginning this month, HSRI will be going to visit each of the MCO catchment areas to provide them standardized training, educational tools for the community, to meet with their stakeholder groups and equip them to have ongoing stakeholder involvement as this resource allocation model is developed. And that is my final slide, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Chairman Dollar?
Ms. Crosby, a couple of questions. on the last item that you were discussing there, on the assessments for the individual services plan under the innovations waiver, I guess my question would be is, it's my understanding that there's litigation that is potentially impacting how that's implemented that's out there. I'd just like your comment about that and your maybe your more broader comment about whether or not there's an understanding with OAH, given that OAH has final agency authority in appeals as to the sufficiency, I suppose, of services that are being provided. Whether or not y'all been able to get some kind of an agreement with OAH on following the actual Medicaid rules.
Excuse me. I will certainly respond to that, but I know that Ms. Larson may have some additional information. On one of my former slides, I did have an asterisk that I think is very germane to this conversation about the litigation. It's very important to us, and it's very important to CMS as they approve this waiver and this process, that individuals who are given their CIS assessment score, that are given a budget, and that use that to plan, know that they have appeal rights at every step along the way, that they are able to ask for the services they think that they need or would support them best in the community. And if the MCO does deny or reduce any of that request, that they are given due process rights and that they are able to appeal through the state fair hearing process up to OAH. We are working very closely with CMS to make sure that Cardinal Innovations, who did do this first, and that everyone successively going forward follows due process according to what the guidelines are set down to us by CMS. And I don't know if Tara has anything else to add to that.
Representative Dollar and Representative Burr, what Kelly stated was exactly the true position of CMS. Our understanding is the litigation is about the due process, not that we are actually using the supports intensity scale to actually implement and use it for cost allocation, allocation of resources. It's about due process. We are continuing to work with CMS regarding when those due process rights have to be provided, but at this point they are given at the time of results of assessment as well as when the actual plan is submitted and a decision is rendered.
Representative Hurley?
I think Mike was
going to... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Watson.
I was just going to say that with regard to the OAH part of your question, we anticipate a decision from CMS within the next couple of weeks around that SPA. Part of our discussions with them have been their requirement of us that we monitor that agreement as we would any other contractor.
Well, if I can just follow up on that point, remind me, because I think y'all have said before, and I apologize for forgetting, but has the department signed or is the department waiting to sign or still negotiating an MOA with OAH?
We have an ongoing MOU with OAH. I think once the our assumption is that spa will be approved, and once it's approved, we would need to look at what conditions, if any, come with that spa around monitoring or communication, and then perhaps have to amend that existing MOU.
Thank you.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the assessments. I know in here it says each person will then be given an individual budget amount that is based on their level of need. Are the assessments done one-on-one? Are they done in groups?
The assessments are individual assessments. Each individual who's on the waiver is the focus of the assessment, but the assessment gathers information from a parent or guardian, as well as multiple service providers, trying to get a really comprehensive picture of what everyone thinks would best support that individual. But it is, each assessment is done on an individual person basis.
Thank you.
Senator Nesbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions on the waiver expansion. I had asked at the last meeting how much of a reduction you were going to give all these other LMEs that are going online. In other words, there with I think we've determined that at Western Highlands, y'all reduced us about 11% over what you had operated the Medicaid system for in that region. Have you got those numbers on these other LMEs yet?
Steve, we actually do have the numbers, and I'll make sure you get those today.
Can you tell me roughly what they are? Are they as deep a cuts as we had at Western Highlands, or less, or about the same? Or
those reductions are very similar for all of the LMEs. There is a, depending on their level of funding and any policy changes or what the historical data looks like, those reductions are anywhere from about 10 to 15%, and we will get you those per member per month rates and the comparison of what those ended up being to the actual fee for service history.
Follow up
question. Explain to me, I don't need a great detailed explanation, but where do you expect them to find these savings when they take over what, and my problem is with Medicaid being an entitlement program, and you've got people at a level of service, I don't understand how just out of the chute you can drop that 10%. I've never seen that work anywhere once they start appealing. So tell me how it works.
When you look at the per member per month, it's made up of a collection of services. And what we do is look at the fee-for-service history and then what might reasonably be expected to result in savings. And a good example of a place that savings have been focused on would be the PRTFs, the psychiatric residential treatment facilities. We have somewhere around 600 kids in PRTFs. We spend about $100 million a year. About half of those are out of state. You know, what we have learned is that many of those kids could be back in their own homes or in therapeutic foster care, getting served closer to home in their home community with significant savings. So what we're looking at is where can we mirror and match up good clinical policy for the people we're trying to serve and potential savings. I think other areas of savings are inpatient care for children, emergency room utilization. All of those are the kinds of things you're looking at when you talk about doing a better job of care management for Medicaid consumers.
Follow-up?
Just a brief follow-up. So you're expecting, by moving this back to the local level, to where the management is where the people are, you're expecting that they'll be able to save 10 to 15% over what the state was operating the system for?
Senator Heiss?
Following up on that, what changes have been made at this point to Mercer's readiness review process in light of what's come out of Western Highlands and their preparedness to make this adjustment?
I think the three big things that you saw in the Western Highlands slide are exactly the things that Mercer is taking a closer look at. We are looking at the internal reporting structure and the way that those reports are used to effectively manage care across the organization. So everything from utilization of services to finance to the performance of the provider network, how is that being reported on and how is that being used in the organization to forecast and better manage care? I think that's something that we're looking at very closely. Additionally, we're looking at their financial planning, how they develop their financial reports, how they have a risk management strategy. We are scrutinizing that a lot more closely. And thirdly, of course, is that we are requiring additional claims testing. We're looking at some of the edits and audits that absolutely need to be in place before go live to make sure simple things like duplicate claims aren't paid or that the MCO only pay claims that they're supposed to. So we're really getting into the weeds on the claims processing and ensuring that those systems are only paying for what they should pay for when they should pay for them.
And kind of a follow-up question to that, but just moving on those same lines, I've had a lot of conversations with several of my county managers over the last few weeks and relating to this area, and I get, even from them, very different points of view of how it's headed and where it's currently standing. But in actual dollars, we kind of see that they've reduced their losses from well over $1 million a month to somewhere right now about $700,000 a month. Where are stop gaps that you think that this will be able to end? Kind of, is there reserve enough to handle that? And if not, when is the department looking at contingency planning for the services they're supposed to be providing, provided that their fund balance expires and they can't move forward?
The numbers that we have on Western Highlands indicate that they are currently on a monthly basis in a positive situation, and that they are headed in the right direction. They have, I think, adequate fund balance. We are monitoring their expenditures on a monthly basis. Ms. Crosby mentioned the audit. One of the things we've asked Steve's financial people to do is go up and just look at their books to make sure that what we're getting and what we see match up. We are also doing just a monthly analysis of their bank account. Because if nothing else, you can see kind of how things are going. Our discussion, which we are trying to schedule right now with an executive committee of their board, would be around issues of they have made some progress, but what are their plans going forward? They need to look at a new IT system or the ability to plug a contractor in there and do that. They've started a process of hiring a new CEO. You know, I think we want them kind of have the discussion about what do they need to do going forward and what would be our contingency plans and when would they need to go into place.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Crosby, along the same lines of where we're talking here, on your slide 5, where you talk about the update claims and IT system, one of the things that we heard in a recent meeting was how far in arrears some payments were to providers. Could you bring me up to speed on what you've done in wiping that out and how soon that can be taken care of?
I think that there's two things. First, the Mercer team that went on site and the audit team that's going on site is looking at all of that too. The encumbrances that they have, when they have they or have they not been paid, and getting them up to speed and making sure everything that is encumbered has been paid for. That was both things, I'm sorry. Both the Mercer team being on site and looking at all the books thoroughly, and then having our audit team go up. They're doing a desk review right now, and they will do an on-site review. It's also extremely helpful when providers or provider associations contact us, of course contact the LME, but alert us when anytime there is anything unresolved. We've been able to assist quite a few providers with unresolved issues. Sometimes it's not that there isn't the best intention to resolve them, but sometimes there needs to be some assistance from us at the department in order to help. So that's been incredibly helpful, being on site, being able to look through their claim system and their books, but also then having providers notify us when there are problems that we weren't aware of.
Follow up.
Are the providers made aware of the fact that you are to be notified? Is that something that's been distributed in terms of information?
We have tried very, very hard to make that clear. We present to the Waiver Advisory Committee every month. We routinely visit provider groups. We have multiple stakeholder groups that we present to on a monthly basis, and we try to let it be known that we are here to assist with the transition. We are here to help rectify any issues. I can't tell you how many meetings I go to on a monthly basis, just trying to make sure that we're out there and letting providers know we are here to assist if they need help.
Senator Nesbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me how Smokey is doing? Now, they're up and running now, I think, aren't they? How are they doing as compared to Western Highlands problems?
I think there's two things, and if you don't mind, I will let Mr. Watson or Mr. Owen talk about the financial information. But they're doing very well. They have a good internal reporting system. They're very quick to notify us of any issues that they have. They've been very responsive when we've gotten complaints at the state level, either from providers or consumers. They've been very collaborative in when different providers have identified problems with their payment system. But also, that's all business operations, and I think that's what we've focused on quite a bit with Western Highlands. So I think that they have been extremely proactive in trying to ensure that none of that happens within their agency. They send us a weekly report every week. They send us minutes from their notices they sent out to providers that they sent out to their board. They're just trying to keep us abreast of everything that's going on. And in terms of clinical information as well, we do get updates every month on how they're doing with their provider network, how consumers are doing, what clinical initiatives they're engaged in. And they are doing well, and they seem very committed to doing well and also collaborating with us very closely at the state level, so we know what's happening there. I don't know if you want to comment on the finances.
Financially, they're actually operating stably. One of the things that they did that's been very helpful is they spent a lot of time and developed a very intricate way of calculating their incurred but not reported claims. So they knew from the very beginning what their financial position was in terms of what was out there to come in. So financially, they look stable at this point.
Go ahead, sir.
Just a quick follow-up. One of the problems I think that I saw at Western Highlands is they were expected to make these savings almost immediately. In other words, they were called to account 6 months in because they'd only saved X percent instead of the 10 or 15 percent. How much has Smokey been able to save? Were they able to reduce the cost of Medicaid that much, that quick?
They're operating within the capitation rate that we're providing to them. So, yes, they've been able to achieve those savings.
Just one last follow-up.
Yes, sir.
On these Mercer readiness reports, are those going to be made public so that consumers and advocates and providers will know what's in them?
Yeah, two comments. I mean, the reports are public. Once they're finalized, we like to have the opportunity to review a draft and to go over them with the LMEs ahead of time. I think the key, and Smokey's and others are good examples, you know, the key to generating savings is to have that clinical management plan in place months before you start so that you know where you're going to focus to begin looking at care so that you're not just starting day one and saying, how are we going to save money? You know that you have 35 kids in out-of-state PRTFs, and you're talking to the DSSs who are the guardians of those children about how do we get them back into the community. So those kinds of activities that are both good practice and save money start months ahead of a go-live date.
Chairman Dollar?
Yeah, I was just going to point out just very broadly that what we're doing with the 1915 BC waivers, we are actually managing the care for individuals for whom there was really no management being done in the past. It was any willing provider in Medicaid. And with the BC waiver, it's not any willing provider. The role of the LME MCO is much different from the role that the LMEs had in the past. And, of course, part of the challenges that they have is that it is a far more complex model, obviously, much more a lot more work to be done and a lot of a lot that we're looking to get out of the system going forward. But we do anticipate an increasing level of savings, not simply to the state's benefit, but also portions of that going back into better services, quality services, and hopefully picking up some people that haven't been able to be served in the past under the old model, that where you really weren't managing the care of anyone, that not certainly not the way we're doing it with the MCO model. But I wanted to ask, I want to follow up with the conversation we had last month with regard to Mecklenburg, and I'll just make this I'll make it easy on you, Mr. Secretary. And I'll ask the question this way. Is your assessment since our last meeting of where MechLink stood at that time changed substantially in these last 30 days?
Mr. Chairman, my assessment has not changed substantially. I am slightly more optimistic. We have asked MechLink to put together a series of milestones that we are monitoring to see what their progress is towards the possibility of going live, and we are going to be monitoring that very closely. As has been stated today and as I've stated previously, I will make the decision before the end of the year as to whether MechLink is able to go live no later than February 1st. That is the same kind of lead time that we have provided for all the other LMEs to go live as an MCO, about a 30-day kind of you're good to go. That I will not make that decision unless I am convinced that MechLink is indeed good to go. In the meantime, we are discussing internally, and I expect we will discuss externally what the alternatives to that might be should they not meet their milestones, what we do with Mecklenburg County, where they might be assigned, what other MCOs may be in a position to take on that that task.
Let me do a follow-up on that. Then is it fair to say that you're not looking at extending someone, at least at this time, you're not looking at extending anyone past, say, February the 1st?
No, I think we've made that very clear to all of the LMEs that are yet to go live, that I will consider a go-live date no later than February 1st with a final determination to be made by me no later than December 31st. And again, if by December 31st I am not convinced that they are able to go live successfully, I will not make the determination that they will go live. And we then have, obviously, 6 months in order to transition that county or those counties in an LME that we've determined not to be able to go live to another LME, another model.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nesbitt.
I'd like to request that when you get ready to give Mecklenburg County to somebody else, we sell tickets to that event. We raise enough money to fix all this.
I'll buy one. Representative Hurley.
Thank you. I have a question about the three-way bid contract. Three-way bid contract. I understand. I just want to ask. I understand that they're behind on payments to the hospitals for the three-way bid contract, and I wondered where it stood right now.
Dr. Melcher, go ahead, sir.
Jim Girard with the Division of Mental Health. Representative Hurley, we are at the current time in conversations with the Hospital Association and the LMEs. We hope that we will have, by the 1st of December, a plan worked out of regular payments and that we'll be all caught up with them. We are in the process of catching them up now, and we hope to be caught up in the month of December.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, as the statute requires, that relationship is between the providers, the hospitals, and the LMEs. The department really does not have a role directly with the hospitals at this time. Our payment arrangements are with the LMEs, who must authorize and verify that authorization for a three-way bid has been met. So we are working, as Mr. Girard just said, we are working closely with both the LMEs and with the Hospital Association to help them figure out how best to move forward so that payments can be made on a timely basis.
Just to follow up.
Go ahead.
Is it true that if they have the contract for 7 beds that they can get by paying for only 5 beds? I've heard this also, and I know my LME is still our, and that wasn't from my LME, but from somebody else, but also our LME is keeping her payments up with funding. But I do know this is a problem. Just a question.
Representative Hurley, if I may, Mr. Chair. I believe that the payments are based on utilization, so a contract may be a contract for 7 beds, but if only 5 were being utilized during a pay period, then they would be based, the payment would be based on the number of beds which had been utilized rather than the number of beds in the contract. It's not a kind of a 1/12 basis.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any additional questions for members? All right. If not, thank you. This time we'll move on to our last item on our agenda, which is the midwife licensure. And we're going to first hear from Russ Fawcett, I believe. And if y'all want to have a seat at the panel, along with two other presenters, I believe, that are going to be speaking on this issue. I think they're going to all present probably within 5 to 7 minutes, and then that'll leave a few minutes for questions for them, and then we'll move over and hear from Mr. Barnes after that. So, and you'll have to hold that mic down there as you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have a few charts to show if those are queued up and available.
We'll get that done. Can somebody?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Russ Fawcett, and I'm the Vice President of the North Carolina Friends of Midwives. And on behalf of North Carolina families that choose midwifery care and the home setting for birth, we very much appreciate your interest and your concern for us. My friends and I, we have just a few minutes each of prepared remarks, and then we look forward to answering your questions. Very quickly, when I first started working on this issue in 2007, working to cultivate a safe and supportive environment for North Carolina families choosing home birth, I would objectively evaluate ourselves as an unremarkable state. We weren't a good state like Virginia, Tennessee, South Carolina, or Florida, but we weren't a bad state either. I will tell you that in the last 20 months, our state has evolved into the most hostile state in the United States for this growing community of families. There have been two criminal prosecutions against a certified professional midwife who could be licensed in our neighbor states. There's been a criminal prosecution of a traditional community midwife and a doula. There have been multiple investigations and cease and desist orders issued. And earlier in the year, the North Carolina Medical Board essentially shut down 8 of 11 certified nurse midwives who attend home birth in the state. There is only one way for any state to cultivate a safe and supportive environment for her families that choose midwifery care in the home setting for birth, and that's to enable access to certified professional midwives and create a framework that promotes success. I have just a few charts to show. Recent epidemiology from the Centers for Disease Control found something noteworthy, and that is a significant increase in rates of planned home birth all across the United States. And in light of the way these trends tend to evolve, I think it's safe to say this is a very noteworthy increase, on the order of 30% relative increase in a very short period of time. And that's the graph on the right-hand side of the screen. The map on the lower left shows which states showed large increases. The shaded states, of which we are one, it's noteworthy that North Carolina, during this study period, experienced one of the largest relative increases, even though our absolute rate is a bit smaller than some other states. This chart describes the many elements of maternity care, the attributes that more and more families are looking at in making their maternity care decisions. So if we compare planned hospital birth to midwife-attended planned home birth, we say similar rates of intrapartum and neonatal mortality. We see reductions in preterm low birth weight babies because the midwives are investing a significant amount of time during the prenatal period. The cesarean section rate is reduced by 80%. Today, in conventional care, one of three women experiences or concludes her pregnancy in cesarean section, and there is a substantial difference. And that also then is associated with rates of complications in future pregnancies. For midwife-attended planned home birth, you can expect one-on-one care during birth, caseload care, which means the midwife who takes care of you prenatally is also the midwife that attends your birth and takes care of you postpartum. Let's see here. Certainly what's noteworthy today is that the cost of a midwife-attended planned home birth is one-third the cost of a normal birth in the hospital setting. Indeed, several years ago, the state of Washington performed a third-party study in which they concluded that their midwife program, their licensing program, saved the state of Washington about $1.5 million per year by cultivating this environment. This chart shows rates of licensing trends. I'll say contemporary licensing methods first started in the late 1970s. In more states, when they confront the need to manage home birth in a sustainable way, they conclude that they must enable access to certified professional midwives. And as you can see, about half of the United States, in fact, enables this, including all of our neighbor states. Of the states that are indicated there, there are essentially three kinds of states. There are states with voluntary licensure of certified professional midwives. Those would be two, Utah and Oregon. 23 states provide for mandatory licensure of certified professional midwives, including all of our neighbor states of Virginia, Tennessee, and South Carolina. Two states legally recognize by statute certified professional midwives but do not regulate. That would be Missouri and Maine. Any of those three circumstances would make for a substantial improvement in our state. And finally, my last chart is a projection of what North Carolina will be like after licensure. One of the first steps would be to assemble the Professional Midwifery Board to promulgate rules and begin issuing licenses. We would anticipate about 30 North Carolina certified professional midwives would seek a license, as well as CPMs in our neighbor states would seek a license. And that workforce could attend on the order of 1,000 women a year. I would expect us to see an initial increase in planned home birth because we see significant numbers of women leaving North Carolina to give birth. And after licensure, we would expect them to stay home. We would expect planned unattended home birth to be minimized. Women who labor at home unattended, who plan to walk into the hospital in the later stages of birth, they will stay home. Regional rates of planned home birth are on the order of 0.5% to 1%, which is would translate to 600 to 1,200 per year for North Carolina. And there's reason to believe that long-term, our expectations are we would follow national trends. We would invest effort in creating a North Carolina School of Midwifery, approved either by the state or the Midwifery Education and Accreditation Council. We have experience in the state in putting that together. In terms of regulation and professional discipline, we would anticipate that there would be some complaints against licensed midwives. The experience in Virginia was that they had five investigations in the first 5 years of licensure. One of the issues we have in the absence of licensure is we do not have quality control over our data. And with licensure, we can assure that the State Center for Health Statistics has quality data to assess outcomes in our state. And simply put, we will have done the best thing we know how to do for this community. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, thank you very much again for your interest. And I'd like to turn it over to Rebecca Walton to relay her thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Walton, and I'm honored to be able to speak with you today about certified professional midwives and home birth in North Carolina. I've had all three of my children at home with a certified professional midwife. The first was 9 years ago, and my last child was born 5 years ago. My husband and I felt like planning in advance for children was the responsible thing to do. So a year before we conceived, I began researching about pregnancy and birth. I wanted to ensure to the best of my ability the safety of myself and my baby. In addition, I wanted the experience to be respectful of my body, my thoughts and plans, and the way I wanted to feed and care for my baby after it was born. The majority of my women, friends, and family members had chosen to give birth in the hospital with the assistance of monitoring equipment and pain medication, and that was a huge relief to them. But to me, the thought of that kind of birth brought a feeling of dread. My brother and his wife had had their second child at home, so I knew something about the quality of care and the type of birth that could be expected from a midwife. I wanted to experience what my sister-in-law had. My husband and I decided that a home birth was the answer, and so the search for a midwife began. At that time, I really had no idea just how underground midwives were here. After searching the phone book with no results and contacting an acquaintance who'd had her children at home, I got online and found one brave certified professional midwife who was willing to list her contact information. I didn't at the time know just how brave she was. After our first prenatal, we were given a packet of information, and one flyer still stands out to me. It said, "Will your midwife be around when you're ready to give birth?" And it went on to lay out the legal obstacles that midwives face. I found out that it was legal for me to have a home birth. It just wasn't legal for my midwife to be with me. The last thing I wanted was to have to make other plans mid-pregnancy, to be left to try to find another underground midwife, or worse, have to go to the hospital or have my baby unattended. Fortunately, I was able to keep my midwife. Since our home birth in 2003, we have had many friends and even family members have their children at home. They are part of the CDC's 29% rise in home births in the United States over the past few years. When women are respected and validated and provided unparalleled care throughout their pregnancy and birth, it is not surprising to see more of them sharing their experiences and causing others to want the benefits of birth at home with a skilled midwife. What is surprising is that in the nearly 10 years since I first gave birth, I have seen midwives in North Carolina come out from the underground networks. I've witnessed open discussions on NC parenting forums and about home birth. I have seen the establishment of home birth support groups and the production of movies and television shows about home birth. I watched North Carolina Friends of Midwives educate the public and the policymakers here in Raleigh about the need to provide legal care for legal place of birth. It has looked as if the number of home birthing families and midwives who were once a hidden part of our state's population were emerging at about the same rate that policymakers were deciding that providing maternity care to these women legally was the right thing to do. Then it all fell apart, and our state has turned hostile toward these families. Now midwives are not going underground. They are moving away to provide care for women in the states that border us. I have friends who have had all their previous children at home who are now pregnant and without a midwife to care for them. Some of them will go to the birth center. Some may opt for a hospital birth, and others will decide to give birth at home with no care provider. Does this improve safety? I'm not planning on having any more children, so for you to provide licensure for certified professional midwives really won't do me any good. I am asking, however, for my friends and my family members and for my daughter and all the women who come after me that you please give us back our midwives by licensing certified professional midwives. Thank you.
I'm Barbara Hotelling, and I'm a women's health nurse practitioner. I have been a home health visiting nurse with postpartum families. I am a volunteer birth doula, a Lamaze educator, and co-chair of the Coalition for Improving Maternity Services. KIMS is a nationwide coalition of around 40 birth and breastfeeding organizations and their 90,000-plus members. I have followed and participated in the development of evidence-based practice, and the presentation I'm giving today is grounded in solid evidence. I don't know how many people are interested in reading the research, but I do have here on page 81S is an evaluation of the research about, and the title of it is Birth Can Safely Take Place in Hospitals, Birth Centers, and at Home. The research is overwhelming. No one contests that about home birth. CPMs are well-trained and certified. The certified professional midwife is a supreme example of a competent practitioner who is disenfranchised in the state of North Carolina, in large part due to objections over the home setting for birth. Physician assistants and nurse practitioners such as myself are trained, we're tested, we're certified, and we're licensed here. We have different methods of training and go to separate schools, but in the end, we all meet the standards and are licensed to practice. CPMs are trained, certified nurse midwives are trained, tested, certified, and licensed here, but CPMs are trained, tested, and certified, but they're not licensed in the state of North Carolina. We all have our limitations. My clients can only be women over 13 years of age, and I am integrated into the healthcare system and can call upon physician expertise when the need arises, which I find very helpful. The scope of practice for certified nurse midwives is different from that of certified professional midwives, yet each fulfills a vital medical need here in North Carolina. certified professional midwives increase access to care. With the ongoing consolidation of maternity services and large centralized facilities, we have significant access to care problems in North Carolina. The Cochrane database, the gold standard of evidence, states that most pregnancies and births should be attended by generalists, which is the British term for family physicians in the U.S., and midwives. Midwives can meet a critical need in rural health care throughout the U.S. The leading cause of neonatal death, according to the CDC, is disorders related to short gestation and low birth weight, so preterm birth and babies who are born too small. Not, and then there are the words not elsewhere classified. These are more deaths than from complications of pregnancy, placenta, cord and membranes, respiratory distress, bacterial sepsis, intrauterine hypoxia, and birth asphyxia. And according to the latest statistics in 2009 from the North Carolina State Center for Health Statistics, 24 counties here in North Carolina registered the fact that one in five up to one in three mothers had late or no prenatal care. And that is exactly what causes the preterm birth and the low birth weight. So what does ACOG say? ACOG is the organization, American College of Obstetrician and Gynecologists. They publish a compendium of standards, guidelines for care that are oftentimes upheld in legal courts. In January 20th, 2011, they published a new committee opinion on planned home birth. The one in the 2007 policy declared that ACOG does not support programs or individuals that advocate for or who provide home births. The recent 2011 opinion states that although ACOG's Committee on Obstetric Practice believes that hospitals and birthing centers are the safest setting for birth, it respects the right of women to make a medically informed decision. ACOG also urges development of integrated systems of care to achieve favorable home birth outcomes. And that development of integrated systems of care is licensure and physician collaboration. Now that ACOG has acknowledged that some women are appropriate candidates for home birth, it is time to proceed with civil discourse. It is time to license certified professional midwives. Their practice can be monitored, and poor practitioners can be disciplined in the same manner as physicians and other professionals, which is perhaps the most critical function of licensing. A data bank similar to the doctors or nurse practitioners can be developed so that CPMs with judgments against them can be published. So whether you think of this as keep your friends close and your enemies closer, or as a means of bringing all practitioners committed to safe and normal birth under the same professional oversight, it is a win-win proposal for the state, the caregivers, and the mother babies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee will be pleased to answer your questions as best we can.
Thank you. Do we have questions for this panel? Senator Hartzell, Senator Allren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My simple question is, what would you say is probably the reason you would give for why the state of North Carolina does not move forward with licensure?
I've been engaged in this for 5 years, and my sense is that the North Carolina Obstetrical and Gynecological Society objects to the home setting for birth, irrespective of attendant. And it has taken a significant investment from my community, my organization, of time to really connect and educate and communicate with the members. And it's been a process.
Senator Hartzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, and I think our personal experiences always play into these things, and I want to thank the chairs for bringing this issue to this group today for an open discussion. Just by way of background, I have a son who's a neurologist, a daughter-in-law who's a pediatrician, and a daughter who wanted to have a home birth in Asheville. She announced her pregnancy at Christmas last year. When she said she wanted to have a home birth, my son and my daughter-in-law were absolutely traumatized by that fact. But my daughter is a very determined soul. She chose to have the home birth. And for 22 hours, she went through labor in July of this year. And ultimately, I mean, within that setting. And then was moved to Mission Hospital and had a C-section. So I say that, you know, this integrated kind of relationship can and should exist. My real question, however, is North Carolina currently, as I understand it, is ranks between 43rd and 47th in the country in infant mortality rates. In a nation that is in the industrialized world, not first, but 15th. So it seems to me that it would be useful, because infant mortality is actually the greatest single indicator of public health or not in any particular state or nation. Has anybody ever done a study? Is there any information out there anywhere that reflects the fact that having certified professional midwives improves in any particular state, in any particular nation, infant mortality rates? It's that simple. Is there anything there to reflect? You showed a chart that had a series of home births and that sort of thing. Is there anything that can indicate data-wise that it improves those rates?
Thank you, Senator Hartzell. For the past 5 years, I've enjoyed Senator Purcell's company on the Perinatal Health Committee, who's charged with that very topic of the Child Fatality Task Force. In North Carolina, the largest component of our excess bad outcomes are preterm low birth weight babies associated with healthcare disparities for our families in our state. What we see in the epidemiology is that midwifery care, similar to centered pregnancy, if the members have heard of that, where you invest significant time during the prenatal period, you improve maternal health and reduce the incidence of preterm low birth weight. Very specifically, in Florida, we can cite an example of a birth center operated by a licensed certified professional midwife who provided care for exactly the demographic in North Carolina and in Florida that experiences elevated rates of preterm low birth weight babies and bad outcomes. And they saw dramatic reduction. For midwife attended birth in the home setting, as we would continue to be, on the order of 1 or as high as 2 or 3%, the statistics tend not to be so dramatic considering the whole population. But we do have high confidence that midwifery care improves maternal health and reduces preterm low birth weight babies.
Also, we were 15th, probably around 1970 or 75, and now in a total of 50 industrialized nations around the world, we are 50th. And lack of midwifery care is cited as one of the primary reasons for that.
Follow up?
Let me shorten my question a little bit. We saw those statistics. Is there anything that actually indicates in those states that have adopted certified professional midwifery, I mean, that situation, that their infant mortality rates have improved? That's my question.
Well, I will say that the top 10 states with the lowest perinatal mortality rate, without exception, license certified professional midwives to manage this part of maternity care. And I think, for me, that's a reflection that the states with the best policies and programs do manage and create a safe environment for this community.
Additional questions, Senator Hartzell?
I'm not asking, yes, let me, I'm not asking for a yes or no, but I'm just saying, is there any evidence to indicate that the adoption of licensure improve in the states where it's been adopted more recently improves the issue, I mean, the infant mortality rates? You said the top 10 states have it, but I mean, is there anybody who's ever actually done anything to look at this as a relevant factor?
I'm not aware of a study in which a state examines it pre and post licensure. I think that that kind of specific study, to my knowledge, has not been done.
Senator Purcell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm not sure, but I believe I've had as much experience delivering babies and taking care of newborns as anybody on this committee. I delivered a lot of babies when I was in the military service and during my training. But, you know, I don't know how many of you have ever done this. I've done it. You go out to the graveyards and you see mothers and babies in the olden days buried together in the graveyards. These were all home deliveries because there was no other place for them to have babies. But let me tell you this. If you have a student at Chapel Hill delivered a baby on the street the other day or helped deliver one, everybody was fine. Well, if everything is normal, everything is going fine, then that's going to work out fine. But I've seen over and over again a number of women who've been said to have normal pregnancies, everything is fine. At the last minute, you have a real emergency when all the bells go off. The placenta prolapse, it's depriving the baby of oxygen, there's bleeding occurring, and if you don't have the ability to take immediate action, I'll guarantee you're going to lose babies and mothers as well. And if you're out, and I'm sure it's a good thing to have your babies born at home, but if you're out 20 miles from a hospital, you don't have an ambulance, anything there, and one of these emergencies occurs, you've got a major problem, if not death of a baby, or you're going to have brain damage or something's going to occur. So the statistics don't really make much difference for that particular individual. And I know that we've been told that the babies born at home are going to be born to women who have normal pregnancies and everything's fine, but I have seen, and you can talk to any pediatrician who helps take care of newborn babies across the state, we see over and over and over again situations where things go bad at the last minute, unexpected. If you got to wait to get an ambulance or transportation or proper people out to in the middle of the country somewhere, and Mark, you probably know about this as well as I do, but It's a disaster. And in the hospital, when this occurs, all the bells go off and you got multiple people begin to take action to try to save the baby and sometimes the mother as well. If every pregnancy was normal, every delivery is normal, we could do like this student on the street corner in Chapel Hill and have a normal outcome. But it's that time when things are supposed to be normal, or expected to be normal, they turn out not to be normal. That's when you've got problems. That's the thing that concerns me about home deliveries. I also would like to ask, what is the training of a certified nurse midwife? Tell me exactly what is the minimum training that they have to have.
Thank you, Senator Purcell. First of all, let me suggest and impress upon the members that women may choose the home setting for birth in our state and in every state in the United States. So, and we agree that complications can arise. We agree with that. And therefore, it is critical that our North Carolina mothers are attended by trained, credentialed, and integrated midwives to keep them safe. In terms of training, the Certified Professional Midwife Credential is accredited by the National Commission for Certifying Agencies, which also accredits the Certified Nurse Midwife Credential. The training requirements are set forth by the North American Registry of Midwives. There are three elements to the training and education. There's the didactic component, or the knowledge. There are the skills that she must possess, and the experience requirements, which are consistent with other providers of primary and maternity care. The training tends to be competency-based training, although there are a growing number of options for the didactic component in a school setting. Does that answer your question on training?
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to also remind the committee that of all the, I don't know exactly right now, but obstetrics, delivering the babies, is one of the most litigious parts of health care in this country, especially in North Carolina. So there's some reason why you need highly trained people to do this type work, in my opinion.
Chairman Dollar.
Thank you. A couple of different questions. Could you explain for the committee just very briefly the difference between a nurse midwife, which is a licensed position in the state of North Carolina currently, and what you're looking to do with the certified midwives?
Yes, sir. So the certified nurse midwife is a primary caregiver to women from her teenage years to her dying days. That includes the childbearing year. She has prescriptive authority. She can perform primary gynecological care and elder care in addition to prenatal labor and delivery and postpartum care. The certified professional midwife does not have that same scope of practice. Her scope of practice is limited to midwifery care, prenatal care, maternity care during the childbearing year for women who seek to give birth in out-of-hospital settings, either a freestanding birth center or the home setting. So their scopes of practice are very different. The certified professional midwife evolved to meet this need of attending women who choose the home setting for birth. The vast majority of certified nurse midwives work in the hospital setting. Freestanding birth centers, about in the United States, accredited by the American Association of Birth Centers, about half are operated by certified professional midwives and about half by certified nurse midwives. All across the United States, the certified professional midwife is the midwife that attends home birth and is the primary care provider. So a very different scope of practice and very different emphasis.
In those birth centers, you may not have this information, but you may be able to get it for us. in those birth centers where, as you say, the mix is about 50-50 between nurse midwives and certified professional midwives, and I may not be using the terminology exactly correctly, but are there mortality statistics? In other words, is there any difference between mortality seen between you know, which individual is taking the lead in those births?
That's a very good question. Yes, there's lots of studies and data associated with freestanding birth centers, and essentially there is no difference between the freestanding birth center setting and the home setting. The midwives in either setting carry the same equipment and can perform the same interventions. The key difference between the birth center setting and the home setting is variation in transfer time. And what the studies tend to say is that outcomes in the birth center setting and the home setting are essentially the same. We do not see noteworthy differences between the two settings. I'm not aware of a study that in the birth center setting that differentiates by care provider.
Okay. Let me ask. Let me ask this question, because it, you know, it seemed from the data, or at least the chart, that you have less than a percent of births that are home births, and that it looked like it had dropped off a little bit, but that it picked up. It essentially was at the same level that it was at back in 1990 at 0.67 of 1%, although it does look like the trajectory from around 2004 or so has been accelerating upward. So is the trend upward? And I guess my question is that trend based on the availability in more states of certified professional midwives, or is that just a trend separate and apart from the availability of certified professional midwives?
That's a very good question. There's not a definitive answer to that, but I'm happy to speculate for you. We tend to believe that the reason for the recent sharp increase is access to information. So today, I don't think women go to Barnes & Noble to get a book on pregnancy. I think they Google. And there is a tremendous amount of information associated with these different options. And as I indicated before, a dramatic reduction in cesarean section, one-third the cost, and these benefits. I think that's the explanation for the recent increase. And in fact, if we see a steady decline until 2004, if we then look here, we see a steady increase in access to certified professional midwives during that time of decline. So from these two, and granted, this is observational, but we certainly don't see increases in planned home birth associated with increases in access to certified professional midwives.
And just one final question, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and that is, I think the issue that is raised more than any other that probably concerns most members of the legislature, irrespective of what their view may be of the issue, and that is the question of safety. And I'm really asking this beyond the question of whether or not it's advisable for someone to have a home birth, because it does seem to me that decision, as the lady indicated here, with three, I mean, that was the individual's decision. It's a legal decision in 50 states, including North Carolina.
so the question becomes, is it safer, or what would your argument be in terms of, is it safer for the individual to have, who's decided they're going to have a home birth for whatever reason? Now, that's not my gig. You know, we did hospital, epidural, you know, that's the way we went. And it wouldn't be a different decision today, you know. So, but, you know, to each his own. Her own, rather. But I guess my question is, how do you answer the, you know, those who say, well, look, is it safer to have, for someone who's made the decision that they're going to have a home birth, to have a certified nurse midwife, or a situation where they have nobody or have somebody who's who would not be in a licensed scenario?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think it makes tremendous sense and really should not be in dispute that mothers and babies are safer at home when they're attended by a trained birth attendant. And in fact, in our state, because they do not have access to trained, credentialed, and integrated certified professional midwives, what we see is elevated rates of planned unattended home birth, and that does increase the risk of a bad outcome. We see women seeking midwives who may not have the same level of training as the certified professional midwife. We see women crossing state lines seeking this model of care out of hospital. In fact, recently, a few years ago, a freestanding birth center opened in Fort Mill, South Carolina, operated by licensed certified professional midwives. 75% of their clientele are North Carolina women. And so what we do not, and in fact, that kind of speaks to the dynamics in which those that oppose the home setting for birth make it less safe in hopes of discouraging the decision. Well, you know, there's lots of experience that says these deeply personal decisions, families will look for options, and they're going to pick the best option they can. And we think we should give them the best options that we possibly can.
All right, we have three more questions for this panel, and we've obviously gone over our 10 minutes, so if the questions and the answers could be brief, that would be helpful. Senator Allred.
Thank you. I have two questions. One of them is, if I'm reading the charts right, it looks like our sister state, South Carolina, has had licensure for 30 years, and so we've got 30 years of experience there with a state that's very similar to us in many, many ways, including demographics. I wonder, my question for whoever could answer this, can we look at their 30 years of experience with midwives, which the state of North Carolina does not have, and can we draw any type of helpful conclusions? That's one question. The second question is, what does the experience of midwifery in states across the country do? What effect does it have on the expenses to the state governments, if any? I noticed that at least one state did save money, but I just wonder if it has an effect in general that can be verified. Those two questions.
Thank you, Senator Allred. In terms of South Carolina, and this is true for the other states in which we have decades of experience. We know no state is going back and regretting their decision to manage home birth safely. And our experience, relationships with our friends in South Carolina say it's working well and has worked well for a long time. In fact, it's just another option that's available to the families. In terms of expenses, the financial cost of care, I'm really glad that you asked that. It is indisputable that this is a terrific lever to reduce the cost of maternity care. You eliminate the facility fee. It's well established that planned home birth with a certified professional midwife is perhaps one-third the cost of a planned normal hospital birth, which may be on the order of $8,000 for talking purposes in the hospital versus $2,500 to $3,000 for the total cost of care for a planned home birth. Professor David Anderson, who's a professor of economics from Center College in Kentucky, did a projection in which he said, if we increase rates of planned home birth to 5% in the United States and planned birth center birth to 5%, so 10% of the total population out of hospital, half at home, half in the birth center, that the United States would be projected to save $9 billion a year in the cost of maternity care. So it's a confident source of cost reduction. And the mothers want it.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your second slide, which was the evaluation methodology, the second attribute listed was intrapartum and neonatal mortality. What would the numbers look like if we remove the qualifying statement for low-risk pregnancies?
There are a number of contraindications for a planned home birth, and they carry different risks. There have been examples of planned home births associated with women who are not good candidates for a home birth with elevated rates of bad outcomes. The numbers are so small that there haven't been studies, so we can't really quote statistically noteworthy numbers, but there has been experience with that. And that's really a strong argument for licensure.
Follow-up?
Yes.
So tell me, pray tell, why getting a license is going to improve your study that you ranted so eloquently about?
I'm not sure I understood. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understood the question. Why you, licensure?
Yeah, well, I mean, the training is qualified to do this. What right. difference would getting a license improve on their training if they're qualified to do it?
Well, every community of practice, every professional community occasionally produces practitioners who don't maintain the standards. And so that's why most states favor licensure and regulation. Legalization in the absence of regulation or licensure, that would solve probably 80% of our problems in our state. Would solve the access to care problem. It would solve the problem of women leaving the state seeking this care. It would make inroads to transfers and consultations. It would not address professional discipline and professional performance.
Senator Bingham, I believe you had your hand raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. How many, Russ, how many births do we have annually in North Carolina that use home births, period?
In terms of the numbers, the largest number is on the order of 350 planned home births per year attended by certified professional midwives. The next largest component of what I will suggest is the same population are the women who travel out of state seeking care. It appears from the State Center of Health Statistics that that number may be on the order of 300 per year. The next component is certified nurse midwife attended home birth, and that's between 75 and 100 per year. So if we include the women traveling out of state, on the order of 800 or so, we don't know the number of planned unattended home births.
Okay, so you're estimating somewhere in the vicinity of 800, and what I hear you say is that we improve the training and expertise of the home births by the licensing, as you have mentioned, because of the number of or the qualifications, et cetera. So the people that are going to do home births are going to do home births, and they may not have a knowledge of the caliber of people they're dealing with, so this is a sort of a safety issue, as I think that's what I hear you saying.
Well, absolutely.
And so, and tell me again how Washington State saved money from, how did you do the calculations on that?
They commissioned a third-party consultant to do this study, and so they counted the reduction in cesarean sections. They counted the reductions in the hospital fee. Hospital fee, my sense, is about the same as the provider fee associated with the planned hospital birth, and other reduced interventions coupled with terrific outcomes were the key sources.
Okay, if I may, one more.
Yes, sir.
Sure. Have you noticed in any other states, you know, these people that are intent on having a home birth, and the quality of care, et cetera, have they had any regrets? Or I did hear you say that none of the states that have passed this, they haven't backed up and decided that it was a mistake. So have you any family members, et cetera, but I also heard you say that you have very few or little or no bad outcomes in this.
Well, the rates of bad outcomes are on the order of 1 per 1,000. And the epidemiologists or the stakeholders argue back and forth whether that's different in the hospital setting. You know, certainly there have been examples of families that, in retrospect, wished they would have made a different decision. And I think that's true for everything in life, and it's also true here.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, members of the committee.
This time we'll hear from David Barnes. Either place you choose, sir. That'd be fine. Turn on your mic first.
My name is David Barnes. I'm legislative counsel to the North Carolina Obstetrical and Gynecological Society. I'm also a poor substitute for Dr. Haywood Brown, who's the president of our society this year. He's a professor at Duke in charge of their obstetrics department. He wished he could have been here but had an unavoidable conflict and could not. But I've been involved in this issue for over 10 years, and it's a very important issue to the doctors that I represent. They take it very seriously. And they would ask you not to license certified professional midwives for at least two reasons. One, because we believe their training is not sufficient or adequate for the type of activity they want to undertake. And number two, if you license them, it will give, in a sense, a seal of approval of the state of North Carolina and will mislead people to believe that they have a nurse or somebody who knows what happens when pregnancies become complicated. So let's talk about the first one, the lack of sufficient training. It's always very confusing, especially this committee knows about acronyms, and you hear so many in the mental health area and that sort of stuff, but think about this. CPMs are not nurses. To get a CPM licensure, you are not required to have any formal medical training. You can become a CPM after being involved in as little as 40 births. Contrast that with a nurse midwife. A nurse midwife is, as it sounds, a nurse. They have to have nurses' training. They have to be licensed by the state of North Carolina to be a nurse. Nurse midwives have to have additional advanced practice training and work with doctors. Contrast that with a physician. An OBGYN has to have a college degree, a medical degree, a residency, advanced practice training, and sees many, many more births than 40, probably in 1 or 2 weeks of residency training. So you can't compare the two. And, you know, I've talked with you all many years about the malpractice rates that OBGYNs have to pay. And I thank you for the work that you all have done on that. But think about this. Even with the training the doctors have, and let's think about this, the advances we've made in the past 7 or 8 years with training for doctors, trainings for nurses, advances in medical technology, we have reduced the maternal mortality rate leaps and bounds. And the same thing with the neonatal mortality rate. But even that, even with the doctors that are the best doctors, that have the best equipment, we still have the highest malpractice insurance rates because the complexities of pregnancy happen and bad outcomes do happen. But why would we think with the most trained people who still have bad outcomes that we would get a better outcome with someone that's less trained? It doesn't make any sense to me. So what is it we say that the CPMs lack? What they tell me all the time is they deal in low-risk women, low-risk pregnant women. Well, my doctors tell me there's no such thing as a low-risk pregnant woman. There's lower risk and higher risk. And that's where part of the problem comes. To determine whether some woman is a lower-risk pregnant woman or a higher-risk pregnant woman, you've got to be able to identify and diagnose lots of different medical conditions that they have no training in. Whether we're talking about diabetes, hypertension, breech babies, a number of different complications that would say this person has no low risk about them. And the same thing on the other side. When you're talking about when the baby comes without any complications, as Dr. Purcell pointed out, I mean, taxi drivers have been delivering babies all the time, but we wouldn't want to license them. Because when something goes wrong, you've got to have the training to do something about it. And that's the kind of training that CPMs lack. Now, I'm not saying they're bad people. I've dealt with Russ Fawcett and Mrs. Fawcett for years now, and they're good people, and we talk with them. But they don't have the training. And most of the CPMs in this state, who are operating illegally, I might add, have had little, if any, formal medical training. So that's the first thing. Now, you don't have to take my word for the lack of training of CPMs. This issue has been studied in the recent past at least two times by this General Assembly. In 2008, Representative Wilkins will remember, we had the House Select Committee on Licensure of CPMs. They held months of meetings, hours of testimony, and they decided that they should not go forward. And in fact, the committee finding was this, and I'll quote, "The committee finds that the educational requirements proposed for CPM training in this state do not appear to be sufficient to assure the safety and welfare of those in their care." And what they recommended was that CPMs have the same sort of training that a nurse midwife would have to have. And also that if they were to practice, they should have malpractice insurance. Now, it is true that there's no law in North Carolina that says a doctor has to have malpractice insurance. But as a practical matter, they all do because you can't operate in the hospital if you don't have malpractice insurance. And that's a big difference. So there was also a study in 2009. We had a studies bill. And the studies bill said, okay, Joint Midwifery Committee, we want you to study whether or not we should develop a licensure for CPMs. Now, the Joint Midwifery Committee is a committee made up of doctors, nurses, and laypeople. And sure enough, in 2010, we had months of hearings, hours of testimony. And they decided after due deliberation that they should not go forward, that this was not a good idea from North Carolina. And a lot of them had various different reasons. And in fact, I'll read one of the nurses on the committee. I'll give you her reasoning why she didn't want to go forward with licensure. She said, "My reasoning is even though I understand that women have the right to decide where they want to deliver, the baby has rights as well. Since the baby cannot speak for his herself, I believe a baby has the right to be born in the safest environment possible with the appropriate equipment to give he, she the best chance of survival." So we've had two studies in this state that said we've studied it, it's not a good idea. Now, you can get, you know, what's that old saying, you got lies, damn lies, and statistics? In this area, the studies are hard to find. They're all over the place, and a lot of times you're comparing apples and oranges. So what the latest findings that we have deal with they did a meta-analysis. That is, a number of statisticians and physicians looked at all the literature that they could find with respect to this area. And they looked at it and applied all the scientific data they had to. And what they found was that planned home birth is associated with a 2 to 3-fold increase risk of neonatal death when compared with planned hospital birth. Think about that. 2 to 3-fold increase. Now, you might say, well, that's just a study. Well, let's talk about this. Senator Hartzell asked the question, well, where have they ever had some place where they have licensed them? What kind of results have they had? Well, in Colorado, in 2006, they licensed CPMs, and they required them to report the outcomes. Now, I might also say, before I get into that, that the forerunner, this North American Registry of Midwives, that's the one that licensed and accredits these CPMs, was the Midwife Alliance of North America. And I am told that they have received this information from these CPMs about their outcomes, but they have refused to release it to anybody who doesn't support their way of thinking. But in Colorado, what they did was, the latest public statistics I've been able to find, they had 799 women who gave birth with a CPM. They had 9 perinatal deaths. Think about that. Less than 800 women, 9 perinatal deaths. That's a perinatal mortality rate of 11.3 per thousand. That's twice the rate in Colorado for the general population. Now, they also talked about people not wanting to go back. I think if you went to talk to the people in Virginia, you'd find that they would like to go back. It's a matter of public record, but there's at least 4 of these women have been brought up. These are people who are certified professional midwives that are being put out to the public that they know what they're doing. When you read this stuff, it will break your heart. People have been asked to labor for hours and hours and hours and do damage to their bodies and deliver a dead baby. And what breaks the heart of my doctors is that this is entirely preventable. We care about our patients, and we don't want patients to die. We don't want children to die. But that's what we think we see when we look at the CPMs. So we've got studies done by you all at your behest. We've got facts. We've got statistics. We say it's not a good idea. So what's another reason for not doing it? One, it will give people a false sense of security. People will think CPMs are nurses, and they know how to handle the complications of pregnancy, when they don't. What they know how to handle is a normal birth, and they do that well. But you don't know it's a normal birth until after it's over with. So as you know, in here, we've said CNMs, certified nurse midwives, people will think they're nurses, and it will give the seal of approval of the state of North Carolina, and we think that's a wrong thing. I wish Dr. Brown was here, because he's been in the emergency room when these babies have come and presented. And what he told me, he said, it's heartbreaking to have a baby that comes and it's dead and you try to resuscitate it. But he said, we're missing some of the point, because a lot of these babies don't die. They end up in the ICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, and may have permanent damage for the rest of their life. We see that especially when you have something called shoulder dystocia. Sometimes babies are big and they just don't want to come out and they get stuck. And then because of that, they can either die or they can damage the nerves in their arm and have permanent paralysis. And this is something that we'll pay for as a society for a long, long time. So I want to say thank you for allowing us to speak. It's an important issue. It's one that my doctors care about and we've worked on a long time. We had a meeting with Russ and his group back in September. And we exchanged views, and we're glad we did. We wanted to find out more about where they were coming from. But nothing we heard was able to change our concerns about the safety, about what they do and what they can't do. And as one of my nurse friends told me, the problem with certified professional midwives is they don't know what they don't know. They don't know the problems that can come up and how to deal with them in a complicated pregnancy. So for those reasons, we would ask you not to consider licensure a certified professional midwives, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
We'll take questions as soon as we get through the next presentation from Amy.
Good afternoon. My name is Amy Whited, and I'm the Director of Health Policy for the North Carolina Medical Society. I will keep my remarks very brief because you've heard a lot of information about this issue, and I am very comfortable that this will not be the last time we discuss this issue, so there will be lots of time for questions and information in the future, I'm sure. But one specific issue that I wanted to discuss were some of the statistics that were brought up earlier. I know one of the charts that was provided included some information in the last slide regarding the numbers of home births that have occurred in our state in the past year, and there was talk of changes in perceptions over the last 20 months regarding the use of CPMs in assisting in deliveries. And I think that that change in perception has come from the large number and disproportionate number of bad outcomes that we have seen as a result of CPM deliveries in our state, based on the provider, not the setting. That's what I would reference. Because, you know, one talking point that I have used several times in the past has been that, you know, a child born using a CPM has actually, you know, has a 12 times more likely to suffer neonatal death. But actually, with the numbers that have been provided today, that jumps to about 58% or 58 times more likely. So the numbers that we're seeing are actually, just as I'm doing some sideline math, you know, are actually a little more startling than I originally thought. So, you know, as you know, I echo the comments made by the OBGYN Society on behalf of the Medical Society, but I know that we'll continue to talk about this in the future. We have, you know, grave concerns over the licensure of certified professional midwives and look forward to continuing to talk about this issue. Thanks.
Okay. Questions from members for either Representative Hurley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question with the population as it is now and with the Affordable Care Act coming, being implemented, and there's not enough providers already. With making the professional midwives have more training and then be licensed, they could help with this situation. I also know that the last joint committee, we were in session, and some of us did not get to go to those committee meetings. So, but I was thinking it was a different outcome. Anyway, I just feel like it still needs to be studied.
Well, thank one you. Of the things that we see is that when you use the term midwife as far as around the world, and there are a number of different midwives. In some places, like in Europe, they have midwives, but those are more akin to the nurse midwives we have here. And one of the things the OBGYNs have been doing, and you'll know this from your service on this committee, is the pregnancy medical home. And so what we're trying to do is connect women, poor women who are on Medicaid, to have a home to where they can be cared for and in a coordination of care and have some better outcomes. So I'm not sure that the provision of services by CPMs would be helpful in that regard, but we would certainly study it.
Chairman Dollar, did you have questions?
Well, one thing, I'd just make an observation, and you and I have had this conversation before, but it does seem to me that most of the argument that is being put forward is more the argument of home birth versus hospital birth, frankly, and which to me, although it's clearly related, it is a separate question, because I don't hear you saying, and maybe you would say, that North Carolina should be the first state in the union to outlaw home birth. But and therein lies the you're not saying that, and we haven't heard that, and we haven't seen that legislation introduced. So the question becomes, I mean, it seems to me the question is out there that okay, if we are going to allow, so to speak, continue to allow home birth, then what's the best manner in which, what's the best framework in which to do that? Now, obviously, a large number of the states have moved over the last 30, 40 years to licensure. One question that you raised was in terms of the medical training, and would you not agree, you won't agree, but would you not agree that you don't want to confuse the situation? In other words, a certified professional midwife is not a nurse midwife. Nurse would not be used and could not be used in that scenario unless that individual was a licensed nurse, because you don't want to put someone out as a certified professional midwife as someone with specific medical training if they do not have that medical training? I mean, you would agree at least on that narrow point.
Well, I would say that I don't speak for the American College of Nurse Midwives. They have their own lobbyists and certainly will speak on this point. But the problem is the word midwife. And that's the thing is when we think of midwife, what does that mean? Most people think that means a nurse. And I wish Dr. Brown was here because obviously he has, you know, more training on this and better answers. But I would say this. I can't make a commitment for the OBGYNs, but certainly if the question was, are you going to have nurse midwives at home delivering babies or CPMs, it would be an easier question for them to answer if it was the nurse midwives. But the problem is, what I've seen over the past 10 years is the more education people have, the more babies they deliver, the more education they have, they don't want to do a home birth because they don't think it's safe. And the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the Society have a policy that says, we believe the safest place for a birth is in a hospital or an accredited birthing center, which, once again, you got to watch out for the language because some people say birthing center is a place where CPMs operate. But that's not what we talk about as far as a registered, regulated birthing center. We have one here in North Carolina. It's in Chapel Hill. And the thing about that, it's staffed by nurse midwives, but it's a stone's throw from the hospital. I mean, literally a stone's throw from the hospital. In fact, Senator Josh Stein's wife was delivered there. But that's a different sort of thing than you're talking about CPMs at a home or some other remote situation. So I think that's what my docs would say.
We are, just to sort of follow off on that for a second, we are still experiencing, problems with, particularly out in the rural areas, with being able to have prenatal care, appropriate prenatal care when you concur with that?
Well, this ain't the answer.
Let me just ask one more thing along this line, and that is, what would be the argument against saying, okay, if you were to have certified professional midwives and have a requirement along with that additional information or information that would have to be approved by the medical board be provided to individuals before they, sign a contract with someone for those kind of services that would explain or provide whatever statistical information or other information or considerations so that they would have that in advance of as they make their decision as to whether or not they want to do a home birth or do a hospital birth. Would having a requirement for that kind of information prior to signing a contract with a CPM, would that in any way alleviate some of the concern?
More education is better, and this sort of reminds me a little bit of what we did last year in this General Assembly, which was the Woman's Right to Know Act, where we said if a woman's going to terminate a pregnancy, she's got a right to know all this information, and she's going to have to go see a doctor. She's going to have an ultrasound. Now, you could do that sort of thing with a CPM. You could say before you want to have a home birth, you've got to go see an obstetrician to make sure you are a low-risk woman. We're going to have to give you the education of the bad things that could happen to you. I mean, we could do that.
Well, just couple of quick things. One, I mean, obviously the lady was here today chose to have three home births. So.
And I'm glad it turned out well. And
No discouragement from that individual. But do you have or can you provide to the committee statistics that show that the licensing or the decision by a given state to create a license significantly increases the number of home births? Because it seems to me from the statistics that I've seen that that's very much an open question because you still have far less than 1% of the births that are home births even with the increase of licensure over the last 30-some years.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing I had was that Colorado information that seemed to indicate after the third or fourth year, they did have an increase. But really what we're talking about is popular culture. I mean, you've got Ricky Lake on TV. You've got a lot of websites that promote this sort of stuff. So I think that has more to do with it than anybody's desire. But I think Russ and I have talked about it. I think, we don't expect that maybe 1% of the people would do it. And for whatever reason, either. But I would say that the best thing you do is educate people and let them know the problems they could have. And in Virginia, the four we had people that were attending births for some people who are obese or diabetic, and it was just way outside their scope of practice. And I don't think that's going to change. I don't know that you're going to have that would take care of that. But, you know, you can't do double-blind studies. I mean, this is the human beings. You can't say, okay, you know, you're going to have 100 women. You guys go over here and have your babies in the hospital, and you have them at home and see what happens. So your statistics, and that's why I would say go back to common sense. I mean, the more trained you have, the more equipment you have, the better results you're going to have. It just makes sense. I don't think that you have to have statistics to show you that.
Well, I think sometimes you do need statistics to back up assertions from time to time.
The statistics that we have are not as safe. Gotcha. But now Russ has got the statistics he'll pull out of his pockets and say, well, it's safe in Netherlands or England or whatever. But here in the United States, it doesn't show forth. So.
Thank you.
I know I'm waiting on the room to calm down in the back. I would appreciate respect of our folks that are speaking and our committee members. You know, I know you're here representing a side, and you would do your side a great benefit if you would show respect to all those in this room. Senator Allren.
Thank you. This may be a question for staff, or it could be for the speaker. I'm not sure. But my question is, these 27 states that are listed in the handout we got from the former speaker about the licensure, can we assume that these 27 states are comparable, or are there such differences in what's going on in those 27 states that they're not comparable?
There is a wide variety. I mean, I think Mr. Fawcett pointed out there were two states that don't have any regulation. All these states, CPMs are okay. But places like Idaho or Wyoming have very detailed, strict requirements as far as what kind of woman is a candidate for a home birth. California has some very stringent requirements. There's some states that do require malpractice insurance, although I don't know that it's actually available or not. So there's a wide variety of the way people have done it, and I think it's a function of how it comes up in the General Assembly. It gets to be, as you all might know, a sort of a contentious sort of thing, and things get passed in different forms. But you get a chart of all the differences. It's pretty...
Follow-up.
I guess my question, which is just sort of an overall thing, and that is, if 27 states license, that's the majority of the states in the country, is there any reason to think that North Carolina would be exceptional or different in terms of safety than the majority of the states?
I don't think the licensure of CPMs has improved the safety in those states, and I don't think my doctors would tell you that either.
I guess another question is, but has it hurt? They are a majority.
Well, you know, as my mama said, just because everybody else does it don't mean you got to do it. But, no, I think sometimes it's worse, actually, because you get a situation where, and I can go back and give you the ones from Virginia, where some of the certified professional midwives just think that if they get the energy in the room right and the woman pushes long enough, that the baby will come out naturally. And that just doesn't happen. And so what you see is, I think they actually, the doctors, their first rule is do no harm. And I don't think that's necessarily what the CPMs follow. I mean, I think they think they're not doing any harm, but.
Senator Bingham, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, did any of the states that you're aware of, did the medical society in those states endorse or recommend licensure?
I don't know if any of them did. I do think maybe in Wyoming, there may be one OBGYN in Wyoming. I think they signed on to that bill, but I can't be for sure. I would say by and large, medical societies, OBGYN societies, are not in favor of this.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Chairman, yes. What about Virginia? I know you mentioned Virginia, and you said you felt they, or maybe I thought I heard you say that they regretted. But anyway, would you comment on their thoughts?
I have had a lot of discussions with the lobbyists from the OBGYNs in Virginia and with OBGYNs in Virginia. And they did not want it, and they don't think it's been a very good idea. And I think there's not that many CPMs licensed in Virginia. I want to say it's about 50 or 57. And, you know, four have been actually brought up on charges. So that's a, I would say that's a higher percentage than you'd see by physicians. But
Senator Hartzell?
I want to talk about statistics. David, my son and then my daughter-in-law, the neonatal pediatrician, agree with you. My daughter, the sociologist, who just gave birth, doesn't agree with you. We are between 43rd and 47th in the country in infant mortality rates. It's a little question. It's sort of a corollary to what Representative Dollar asked. Is there a state in the country that's ahead of us in terms that has a lower infant mortality rate that doesn't license certified professional midwives? My question is, how can we improve the infant mortality rate that we have in the state that has been persistently among the worst in the country? Is it by allowing licensure and letting other folks deliver it under certain circumstances? We talk about education. How do we improve the infant mortality rate? That's my question.
Well, I think what the Friends of Midwives and if the Child Fatality Task Force and their perinatal health committee would tell you is that the vast majority of it relates to preterm births, you know, bad socioeconomic status. And really, I mean, if you think about it, if Russ is correct with his numbers, Mr. Fawcett is correct with his numbers, 300 people delivered babies in a home birth setting. Statistically, that number, even if you say 10% of them had bad outcomes, is so small compared to the other stuff that it doesn't make that much of a difference, I would suggest. I don't know.
But if you had more, would it?
Well, not the
that's really the question. That's what we have to discuss from a global perspective. That's
if you take the experience of Colorado, no, it would not. It would increase the infant mortality rate. And actually, it, the proper way to look at it is neonatal mortality because infant mortality is from prior to birth to 1 year, and that's more of a pediatric kind of thing. But the neonatal mortality rate is what you really look at. That's surrounding the birth.
Senator Allred?
Yes, if I could just at least answer one of Senator Hartzell's questions. I think there are two states for sure that have worse infant mortality rates and don't license, Mississippi and Alabama. They do not license, and their infant mortality rates are worse. That's at least two.
Further questions from members of the committee? All right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chairman Dollar?
Not a question, but just to kind of get this doesn't really answer Senator Hartzell's question either, but I do think that if you get a chance to go to the neonatal center over at Chapel Hill sometime, you should do that because they've put a tremendous amount of resources in over there. They have a world-class facility for incredibly complex pregnancies. We had an individual that was on the General Assembly staff whose wife was over there about a year or two ago. You should go do that. And the other thing I would just mention just very briefly is that, and this was mentioned earlier, in terms of the pregnancy home model through CCNC, they are working on trying to get at the issue of better prenatal care to move that number up, to move to the successful pregnancies up and get us out of the basement in terms of infant mortality rates.
Senator Allred.
Since we're on the subject about the mortality, it is a really good question. I think it's something good to consider, but if you look at the map of the states that license, a lot of these states, I guess most of the states that do license the midwives have better infant mortality rates. So, I mean, so, yeah, if so, so, so yeah, but my question is if the states have better infant mortality rates when they license midwives, I thought that you were against licensing midwives.
No, he's not against it.
Are you either way? Are you for or again?
Senator Hartzell.
Or are you indifferent?
The answer to that is yes.
All right, I think we've had enough today, y'all. Representative Murray.
Saturday is World Prematurity Day for the March of Dimes, and so I think this is a good segue and final point here is that prematurity has very little to do, it has just as much to do with the mother and the preterm condition of the mother, so I would encourage all women of childbearing age to drink some orange juice this evening.
Very good. And final comment before we adjourn, if you may have seen it, you may not, for our upcoming meetings in December, we will have our normal meeting at the normal time, but in January, our meeting is scheduled for the afternoon of the 8th, and that is done in order to give all the members time they need to attend the Hunt Educational Institute conference that will be held, so that we don't have a conflict there. So we'll have an afternoon meeting in January the day before we return for the opening session. So with that, we are adjourned.